is. How do I focus in? Yeah.
You want to get that thing? Okay. That sounds good. All right, welcome to Psychophysiology. I have some handouts of the syllabi. Some of you may have already printed out a copy, but if not, I have a copy here as well. Depends when you printed it out. The readings may have changed, so this is the up-to-date copy, and there's also a copy online as well. The online syllabus has a few features that you might want to make note of, and the best way to get to it is simply to go to my homepage and follow the links to courses. So I'll just show you that now, so it might look familiar. So you can see that up here we have the courses that I teach. And then there are two psychophysiology links. Back in 2004, I did a video podcast of this course, or it was actually a video, digital video of this course that was not a podcast. It was kind of clunky. So that's old stuff. It's there as a resource. It's a complete course from that time, minus a couple lectures that didn't get videotaped properly. This will be the link for this semester. Obviously, it says 2008. And as you can see, again, we're trying to video podcast it. I'm also trying to audio podcast it. I'm not taking any chances. So you'll have a chance to view those or listen to those quickly after the end of class. So here's the actual copy of the syllabus. And there's a printable version of PDF that'll look just like the one that I handed out in case you lose that. What I'll also show you here before we go over the syllabus is that there are a couple of links that you might find of use, and they're only here on the syllabus, one of which is links to the podcasts and lectures slides. So if you click on this, you'll go straight to it. And for each day, you'll see a link for an audio podcast, which of course doesn't work yet because I'm still talking, a link to a video podcast, same problem with that one, and then also a link to today's slides, which hopefully will always go up just before lecture, but that will depend upon my ability to get them done in a timely way. So that's today's lectures as a PDF, so they're all in color, just like that. So you might find that of use. Okay. Yes, I noticed the information bar. Okay. So everyone has a syllabus now. I'd like to spend a little bit of time today just going over the syllabus and also take care of any enrollment issues and talk a little bit about the class format. So before I go over the syllabus, let me just see who is here from Psych 401A and then Psych 501A, and then if there's anybody I don't call, I would need to know that. So Hallie Brown, okay. Ashley Bunch.
Yeah.
Jennifer Cardenas. Jennifer? Okay. Mari Cosentino? Sarah Fraser? Elena Glatling?
Elena.
Elena? Okay. Tony? Huskerstan? Alex Kyle?
Keel.
Andrew Marshall? And Heather Thompson. Okay. And in 501A, Amanda Brody, Elizabeth Campbell, Anastasia Grubanova, Philip Hall, Lauren Lee, Ashley Mason, Andrew Mojica, Roisin is getting the stool, Alicia Smith, Joseph Thomas. Never knew your first name. Reva Tokashinsky. And Jeffrey Witzel. Okay. Is there anybody I didn't call? Yes.
Well, I'm just trying to get in class.
Okay, for 401 or 501?
401.
Okay, what's your name?
Julie Shaw.
Oh, yes. Okay. S-H-A-H, right?
Yes.
Okay, anybody else I didn't call? Let me see. All right, I'll add you. All right, and then for the lab section, I'll just confirm who I have registered for the lab, so you don't need to say here or anything. For 401A, I have Jennifer Cardenas, who's not here, Tony Cuskerstan, who is, and Heather Thompson. And then for 501A, Amanda Brody, Elizabeth Campbell, Anastasia, Philip Hall, Lauren Lee, Ashley Mason, Roisin O'Donnell, Leisha Smith, Joseph Thomas, Reva, and Jeffrey Whittle. Anybody expected to be in the lab that I didn't read their name? Okay. So 401A and 501A meet together. 401B and 501B meet together. The only distinction is whether you're registered for graduate or undergraduate credit. And that will have some bearing only at the time that I assign grades. There'll be a separate grading scale for 401 and a separate grading scale for 501. In all other respects, the work and everything is identical. Okay, so going to the syllabus then. So hopefully you had an idea to get some sense of what this course is about. And it's a course on psychophysiology, which we'll be spending some time defining today. And we're going to provide an overview of principles, theory, and applications in psychophysiological assessment. So it really has a couple of goals for the course. One is to provide an introduction to theory and research in the major areas of psychophysiological research. And I'll just start doing that by way of a broad overview today. And then as we go through the syllabus, you'll see we'll start hitting different response systems and their applications. And we'll try to link these to various content domains, but it's mostly a course about the methods because the number of different content areas where psychophysiology can be used is vast, and we couldn't cover that in a semester. So I'll try to illustrate different uses of different kinds of psychophysiological measures in areas that span cognition, emotion, psychopathology. And then also I'd like to provide some introduction to laboratory techniques and recording in psychophysiology. And to do that, there are really two ways that we'll try to accomplish that goal. One of them is by the lab section, for those of you who've enrolled in the lab section. We'll actually be conducting experiments in the lab, analyzing data in the lab, and then writing short reports, like a brief method and results section in the lab. But for those of you who haven't registered for the lab, you'll not be excluded entirely. We'll also be doing some demonstrations in here. I have some small portable recording equipment. We'll record some sample signals. We'll show you how to analyze those signals. So we'll be looking at data routinely as we get into the different response systems. So you'll see how we score skin conductance responses. You'll see how we look at EKG recordings, for example. So ideally, if you really want to get the most familiar with psychophysiological recording, you take this course with the lab section. And it's not required to take the lab section, but if you're taking the lab section, you must be taking this section. So that probably should be said to people who show up at the lab section without being here. All right. So the course structure, we'll have a combination of lecture, discussion, and demonstrations. I'll be lecturing most of the time. The discussion will come when you have questions or comments or things that you think we ought to delve into or something I didn't make particularly clear. And the demonstrations will be recording signals from volunteers in the class, just not as an experiment, just to kind of show you what it looks like, and you can see signals in real time, and you can ask your classmates to do things to demonstrate changes in the signals. And then I'll also bring in samples of signals that we might take a look at. So you saw some signals scrolling across the screen at the beginning. Those are just some EEG signals. It's an example of the kinds of things that we can look at in here. Let's see. So there's, if you have psychophysiological data you'd like to see if it fits into this class and want to take a look at it, you know, certainly let me know. I know some of you in the graduate level may have some psychophysiological data. Also, there's no explicit participation requirement, but I do anticipate you'll get more out of this if you ask questions as they come up, and you should assume that if you have a question, somebody else has probably at least thought of something along that line, so don't be afraid to ask it. So just interject your questions as they arise. The other thing that I'm going to do is use this highly technical 3x5 card, and this serves two purposes. It's a chance for you to ask questions that you might have felt silly asking in class, or that it was an interesting question, but you thought might be a little bit off topic, and so rather than derail things, you could put it on here. Also give me some feedback. The feedback could be, I was really getting things very well until you got to that one section, and something fell apart for me. That would be fine to let me know that. So I'll get some feedback, and I'll start each class with what I call 3x5 time, and that's where we'll pick selected 3x5 cards, and I'll try to provide some reasonable explanation or answer or clarification on what came up by the 3x5 card. What this will also do is it's a chance to take attendance. So attendance does count for 10% of the grade in this course. So I'll send these cards around, and just by the end of class, have your name, your section number, and then your question or comment for the day. Okay, in terms of readings, there are two main sources and then many ancillary sources that will be available for download. The main single source is this book, which carries some sticker shock with it, I admit. It's the brand new volume of the Cacioppo, Tassinari, and Bernson Handbook of Psychophysiology. If this is a field you're serious about, it's a really good reference. I realize it's a little bit expensive, and there are a couple of alternatives that I've identified. By email, I showed you it's available as an electronic book. I also think you might be able to request chapters from the library as an electronic document delivery, but I'm not sure if they're going to go for that, but I'll give you the link for that in a minute. We're certainly not going to read all, 30-some chapters, 36 chapters in this book. We will cover, 10 or so chapters in the book, and there's a lot of other things in here that I think you'd find as a useful resource. So you'll see for most of the response systems, we'll start with a chapter in this book because they provide really nice overviews. The other main textbook you'll see as a class packet, it looks like class notes, and it should be in the bookstore. Anybody can disconfirm that? No, okay. It's actually the first five chapters of this 1986 volume on basic electricity. Basic electricity hasn't changed that much in 21 years, so it's fine to use. What's nice about this is it's a self-paced teaching guide. So if you're familiar with electricity, this will be very basic, I'll admit, and you can zoom right through it. If you've never had electricity, this is a great thing to get you introduced to basic electricity. I'll also be giving a little bit of a lecture on this the next time, but you might say, well, why are we taking electricity in a class on psychophysiology? It's because everything we do in psychophysiology involves recording some sort of electrical signal, and some of the lab safety is dependent upon knowing a little bit about electrical voltage and current. So it's just a few basic things in here. We'll cover it next time in class as a starter, and you can proceed through this programmed learning text. There's going to be an electricity test at the beginning of class, I believe it's February 18th, and it's a test that you have to pass. So if you don't pass it the first time, you can take it again. But this will be something that you'll need to do. Now, passing isn't a perfect score, it's 80%. All right, let me make sure that that's what I said here. Passing, yes, passing is 80%. Okay. Now, the rest of the readings are listed for each week, and I'll show you how to access those in just a moment. Now, as I mentioned, 401 and 501A are identical courses, but they're administratively distinct, so that undergraduate students are compared with other undergraduate students and graduate students with other graduate students in terms of grading. I don't have any kind of a forced curve, but what I will do is add up all the points for the class. Those points come from your electricity test, your attendance, a research proposal to conduct a psychophysiological study that would be of interest to you, and a take-home final. Somebody for 501A will have the most points, and someone for 401A will have the most points. And for each of those sections, that score will be considered 100%. And then anybody who has 90% and above of that would get an A, 80% and above would get a B. So in theory, everybody could get an A if everybody scored at least 90% of the top score. Now, just a word about those assignments. There's not a lot of assignments along the way. So if you're not particularly self-disciplined, you could find yourself kind of cruising along, and things would be going fine until at the end you'd find a lot of reading. So you might want to do something to try to kind of pace yourself with the reading. The electricity test is mandatory, so you'll keep up on that. But the rest of the reading, there's no requirement that you have it done. Well, I would ask that you have it done, but there's no way that I will check that you have it done each and every week. You'll get more out of the course if you can read things in advance, and you'll certainly save yourself hassle later during the take-home final if you've read things along the way, and then you'll know where to find material for your take-home final. Okay. The research proposal paper here, I'll give you details in a couple of weeks or so, but it's designed to be in the format of an R03 grant application for the NIH. So that's about 10 single-spaced pages in a format that really makes you think very clearly about testing research hypotheses. It gives a little bit of background literature review, but mostly focuses on the methods of the study. And that's what I want you to get out of this class is give somebody enough background information about what it is you want to study, and then apply psychophysiological methods, detailing them in a way that would convince me that you could actually conduct a study, a psychophysiological study. So I'll have more information along the way. Before you start writing the paper, I'll ask everybody to send me about a one-paragraph synopsis of their idea, and then I can give you some feedback on that, maybe some suggestions for making it easier for yourself, or some suggestions to look into things. And then once that's approved, you can go ahead and start writing the paper. So I'll have more information on that in a little while. Okay. All right. Incompletes. Short of a major medical illness or global catastrophe, there are no incompletes. I have found incompletes usually just move problems from one time to another. So I've given only one incomplete in the last 10 years for this class. Okay. And I have a bit here on academic integrity. I expect there's no cheating, no plagiarism. Okay. All right. So in a bit, I'll go through these sequence of topics and readings, but I want to point out one other link here. There's a link to a reading list that allows you to download PDF documents of all the readings that you might need. Because those are copyrighted material, they can't be an open link, so you... Oops. That's what happens when you do it wrong. Let's see. This doesn't work with this browser. It works with Firefox. Let me just see if I can get this thing in Firefox. Okay. So, when you click on this link, it's going to ask you for a password. If you get it wrong, you get the red page that you just saw. The top secret password is my last name, case sensitive. And when you do that, you get really the second part of the syllabus that has the topics and a couple of general links. Once again, there's a link to the podcasts and the lecture slides. There's also a link to the electronic book. Now, I tried this right before class, and it didn't seem to work. But if you click on that link to the electronic book, it'll open up a new window. And this is our own University of Arizona Library listing of all of the different Handbook of Psychophysiology entries we have. There's the second edition. There's two copies of the third edition, one in Science, one in Maine. Some handbook from 1972. And then here's the electronic resource right here. Okay. So if you click on that, it's then going to take you to a new page that might take you just a moment to find, but there's yet another link here in the middle. It says click to view the book. And you click to view the book, and it's going to ask you for your CAT card information. So you need your name and your CAT card number. My CAT card happens to be all asterisks. Let's see if it works now. It didn't before. But so there it is. You can see the book. And you can either read it online or download it. If you download it, then you also have to get this other program from Adobe that takes a while to install and such. So that could be handy if you were going to be off the web and wanted to read it, but you can only check it out for one day. It's your only choice, so you can't, take it on a long weekend. So to read it online, you just click here, and in a moment, it should load it up, and then you can go right to any chapter, for example. So if we go here to the first chapter, it's a little slow, I found, but it eventually works its way through. maybe. But has anybody tried this since I sent around one? Did you have a look? So there it is. You know, it looks pretty good. There's a limited number of pages you can print, and in testing it out, I printed my allotment in one time. And then it didn't print because I was trying to make an Adobe PDF document of it. So I can't print anymore at all. And it seems to remember me. No matter what computer I go to, it's tied to my CAT card. So it's better than Homeland Security. So it even lets you copy some pages. But, you know, at least it's there. You can read it if you need to. So that might be an option for some of you. Okay. So, and then for any of these others, now that you've gotten to this page using the top secret password of my last name, it's now an open link, and you can just click on it, and then it'll just come down as a PDF, like that. Okay. All right. So let me just go quickly over some of the topics we'll be covering. As I said, today we'll talk a little bit about what is psychophysiology, what are some problems in inference. If you see a particular psychophysiological finding, what kinds of things can you reasonably infer and what kinds of things can you not reasonably infer? And then I hope to just give you a little sense of the excitement about psychophysiology and reviewing some example studies of things that I think are particularly creative uses of psychophysiology, things that might get you excited about the topic. If it were earlier in the semester, I guess the point would be you get to see what the course is about before you decide whether you're going to take it. But we're, if we still have a drop-dead deadline, I'm not sure it's that's really a point of it anymore. But hopefully you'll share some of my excitement by the end of the class today. So then in the next class, we'll be covering some foundations. It'll be a review of neuroanatomy and neurophysiology and a review of basic electricity. Now, some of you may not have had basic electricity, so it'll be the first time. Most of you have hopefully had some neuroanatomy and neurophysiology, and I'll cover that again with just a review in mind. There's one chapter that also has kind of a basic overview of neuroanatomy and neurophysiology. It comes from the first edition of this handbook that was paperback and much cheaper, but they managed to cut that chapter out of the handbook. All right. And those two topics may go a little bit into the next lecture. We'll see how that goes. And from there, we'll start walking through different systems, different response systems that are used in psychophysiological research. And I cover them this way only because I want people to have a foundation in the use of each system. I'm not implying you should just record from one system, but I'm really interested, ultimately people would be interested in integrating across different response systems. But I think it's useful to learn about them in this way because you'll really get to understand what is the basis for the signals we record, what are the methods we use for recording the signal, and then what are the inferences that we can make once we see a pattern of results with those signals. So we'll talk about the electrodermal response system, also known as skin conductance response or galvanic skin response. It's a little bit of sweating, usually at the tips of the fingers or on the palms of the hands. It can also be the palms of the feet. It's used in a lot of studies that are interested in concepts like arousal or anxiety. And then we'll also talk about a specific application of that, which is polygraph testing or lie detection. It's an area with a bit of a checkered past in psychophysiology, and it's an area with a lot of applied consequences and something I think people should know about, so we'll talk about that as well. And then this class with the basic electricity test on the 18th will probably allow about an hour for that at the beginning of class. And then after the break, we will come back and we'll either finish deception detection or talk about the ocular motor system, depending on where we are in the class. We'll go on and talk about cardiovascular psychophysiology. This is a huge area. In fact, as I was reviewing other syllabi online, again, as I was preparing this year, there are syllabi that take an entire semester just to cover this topic. We'll spend about a week, maybe a week and a half at the most, depending how things go, talking about the cardiovascular system. We'll talk about the skeletal motor system, where we record electromyographic activity. Often this is facial EMG, recording the muscles of the face, but there are also other muscles that we might record. And then we'll move up above the neck, and we'll talk about recording brain electrical activity. And there are several lectures devoted to that. There are two lectures that are devoted to looking at brain electrical activity as a function of oscillations over time, or the frequency of oscillations. And Some of that then will lead nicely into a guest lecture from Dick Bootson and Keith Friedel on the polysomnograph and issues in sleep research. So polysomnography looks at frequency of different brain electrical activity as a way of coding when people are asleep and what stage of sleep they may be in. After that, we'll talk about a specific subset of brain electrical activity known as the event-related brain potential. And this is specifically brain electrical activity in response to some event, usually that an experimenter controls, showing pictures, showing words, specific times in a film, things like that. A lot of the papers in this section are really the seminal paper that identified different components of these event-related brain potentials, and so you'll be reading some literature that varies from very recent to very old on this. Okay. We'll have a second guest lecture, this one on the 21st of April by Lee Ryan, talking about functional neuroimaging using positron emission tomography as well as functional magnetic resonance imaging. And then we'll conclude with a couple of advanced signal processing topics, and these will be kind of specialty approaches to dealing with the very complex data sets that we gather in psychophysiology. Some of you who may go on to do work in neuroimaging may borrow from some of these techniques. Others of you may not, but hopefully you'll find it of interest. You can see that right before class starts on the 5th, that's when your paper is due, and I'll just have you email your papers to me. We'll do this. We'll have a paperless paper. So, and then your final exam is due 1 week later. So when you come to this class on May 5th, your paper will be turned in. We'll have the lecture, and at the end of class, I'll give you the take-home exam, and you just have to get that back to me 1 week later. Now, if all that reading and those topics don't seem like enough, I have three other resources for people who are, as I call, seriously inclined. And these are not required for the course in any way, shape, or form. But if you, by the time we get to the end, are very interested in this, there are three books that I'd recommend. One of which, it's now in a newer edition. I just have this edition, so that's the one I put up there. It's Richard Lyon's Understanding Digital Signal Processing. It's an accessible book that you really do understand digital signal processing as a result of reading it. And then there's a software tool known as MATLAB that's very handy for doing things with all kinds of data, including psychophysiological data. And so a nice introductory text, MATLAB for the Behavioral Scientist, was written by Rosenbaum, actually, as he taught an advanced undergraduate course on using MATLAB. So it's a very readable book and an introduction to MATLAB. And then there's a specialty book, Digital Signal Processing Using MATLAB, here by Engel and Prakas. So if those are of interest to you, they're listed there. Okay. Now, the class, it runs from 3 o'clock until 5:50. That would be a long time without a break. So we'll take somewhere around a 15-minute break about midway through each class period. Okay. So if I get too caught up in my own exuberance and it looks like it's a break time, somebody could say, how about a break? And I wouldn't be necessarily offended. All right. Now, the Psychophysiology Laboratory only meets for didactic sessions on 4 occasions. All the rest of the work will be scheduled in small groups with the TA for the course, Jim Cavanaugh. Many of you know Jim. So there will be 4 different laboratory meetings, each one of them covering a different response system. So we'll have a skin conductance laboratory, a cardiovascular laboratory, an EEG laboratory, and an ERP laboratory. It's the acronym laboratories. These dates were determined in part by when Jim was available and in town, and also we're working around schedules in my laboratory. We don't have a teaching laboratory, so we're turning a part of my laboratory at different times into a teaching laboratory. Okay. So these will meet in room 409, which is my laboratory, at these times, and we'll have a session where we go over what's the experiment going to look like, how do we record the signals, we'll practice hooking up, we'll show you how to do the hookup. We'll make sure that you have a pretty good sense then at that point of what you're going to be doing when you come in, and we'll assign people to groups, and the groups will mostly be based on schedule convenience. So there'll be a time, let's see, you know, Tuesday at 5, who can come? 3 people can come, they're now a group for this particular experiment. So we'll work that out at each of these meetings, so you may work with different groups as you go through the lab at different times. And then the due date is listed in parentheses here. So you'll have a couple weeks to get the experiment done and write up the skin conductance lab, for example. Again, a couple weeks here, a little bit more there, and a couple weeks there. We'll be showing you how to analyze the data as well. In some cases, we may do a little bit of the analysis for you, but as much as possible, we're going to try to have you do the analysis along the way. Okay. There's just one reading to do in advance of this, and it's a laboratory safety reading. And this is not available in the online book because this is only available in the previous edition of this book. And this is also a link. Now this one comes off the main page, so it's also password protected, and you can probably guess the password. And then it's just general laboratory safety. Okay. All right, so are there any questions by way of overview? Yes?
So what will the format of the electricity test be like?
It will be a multiple choice or short answer, fill in the blank, or label a diagram test. So you might see a circuit diagram and have to label a part of it. You would have to solve for the drop in voltage across a certain resistor in a circuit. Actually, I think it might only be a couple multiple choice. Most of it's just short answer. Okay. All right. Class format, we'll have some lecture. We have some questions. We take a break midway through, and then we'll come back after the break and keep going. Okay. Let me pause just a moment. We're going to check out the video equipment, make sure that this isn't all just for naught. So we'll pause it and see if it works, okay? So if you need to stretch, go right ahead.
Well, the sound is perfect. And I have you. What do you think that looks like?
Yeah, you can see that.
Yeah.
That's fine. I wish we could just, you know, break the front four bulbs. That would be perfect.
That would be good. What's happening? Do you want to see? Should we go back and watch a little bit?
Just a little bit. Yeah,
well, I'm not sure.
How much should
go back? I think we can just cut this.
Well, we're at 26, 24. That's enough. Yeah, that's enough. Let's see. I can hear if you put it back in.
Oh, okay. Can you hear it?
Let me pause. Are you ready back there? All right. Okay. So I should also thank Roisin. She's volunteering to do this. She runs over, she schleps the recorder over every time, and she monitors it, and then she schleps it back each week so that we can have the video podcast of this. Okay. Oh, one last administrative issue. So this is an unknown gamble here, but if you go to this link, there's a document delivery service that again requires your CAT card number, and then you could request a chapter or chapters from the book. I don't know what they're going to do if, you know, they get 20 requests for chapter one of a psychophysiology textbook, but you might give it a try, and if you do, let me know how it goes. I don't know. It said it's available to all university faculty, staff, and students who have a valid CAT card.
There's no limit. I use it all the time.
Okay. So good. This might be a good way as well.
I think there might be a limit to the amount, like the percentage of
book of the book
that
yeah.
you are allowed to.
Hopefully, with us, it's such a big book, and you know, we only have about 10 chapters. I think that might be all right. Okay. All right. I'll leave that up for just a second. While that's up there, let me hand out now. These are miniature slides that go along with what you have. Some are very readable as they are. Some of the pictures and things don't come out quite so nicely, but I can't really make them any bigger or we'd start wasting a lot of paper. So this is hopefully an idea to take some notes in. You know, you can go to the color slides and see a full color rendering of anything that you've seen in class here. All right. So, we'll talk before the break about a few general issues in psychophysiology. We'll try to come up with some definition of what psychophysiology is, what the appropriate scope of psychophysiological research is, what kinds of research it would encompass, We'll talk about an inference problem that is given a pattern of physiological findings in a psychophysiological experiment. What kinds of things can we infer? And conclude with a few prospects and problems for the field before... problems and prospects for the field before we then take a break. Okay. All right. So there's no shortage of definitions in psychophysiology. So to begin with, the history of psychophysiology as a unified discipline goes back to a group of scientists that were regularly corresponding in the 50s with a vehicle known as the Polygraph Newsletter. And in 1960, they incorporated as a Society for Psychophysiological Research, and so that's often dated as the start of this field. And in 1964, that Polygraph Newsletter became the journal we now know as Psychophysiology. And in that initial journal, there were several articles that were dealing with definitional issues in this field. So Chester Darrow, who was the first president of SPR, in his presidential address, simply said that psychophysiology is the science which concerns physiological activities which underlie or relate to psychic events. And I should say, there's a bit of a contemporary shift in how we talk about psychic events. Psychic phenomena now are thought of as parapsychological, and psychic events at that time were just taken to mean psychological events. Now, in that same issue, Al Axe, the first editor of the journal Psychophysiology, in his opening editorial said, "Psychophysiology is a research area which extends observation of behavior to those covert proceedings of the organism relevant to a psychic state or process under investigation, and which can be measured with minimal disturbance to the natural functions involved." So he was contrasting this to other kinds of physiological recordings, which were quite invasive at the time, things that you do with animals, for example. These are relatively non-invasive kinds of procedures. He says, "Modern psychophysiology is a response to the challenge inherent in the full realization of the complex nature of the human organism." So he's also hinting here at the idea that we're not measuring a single response system, but we're trying to link a whole physiological response pattern to meaningful psychological events. He goes on after a few sentences in between to say, "Psychophysiology provides a method for bringing both physiological and psychological aspects of behavior into a single field of discourse by which truly organismic constructs may be created." Okay. You can see this is the introductory editorial to a brand new journal that just came out in 1964. Okay. Now, also in that same issue near the end, in a section of correspondence, John Stern, who was also an early president of SPR, said, "I would like to offer as a working suggestion that any research in which the dependent variable is a physiological measure and the independent variable behavioral one should be considered psychophysiological research." This was a clear attempt to distinguish it from physiological psychology, which had a tradition instead of manipulating physiology and looking at its effect on behavior or experience. Here, manipulating behavior, manipulating experience, and we'll see what the effect is on physiology. That would be appropriately psychophysiological. And so here in this first issue of Psychophysiology, he has a table, and you can see that under physiological psychology, the appropriate methods are things like brain lesions and brain stimulation, things our undergraduates probably wouldn't do, drug administration and diet manipulation, things they probably do, and auditory stimulation and vigilance experiments, which they do. Okay, and dependent variables over here, of course, are things that, you know, would look behavioral, learning, performance, conditioning, food selection, and so on. Psychophysiological experiments, on the other hand, he saw independent variables relating to behavior, sleep deprivation, individual differences like psychiatric state, states like dreaming. Along this, you know, you can have things like learning, attention, those could all fit in here. And then the physiological measure was the dependent variable. I think this was a really good start, but it's probably unduly limiting for the field of psychophysiology, and since then other people have said it's probably insufficient as a start. There are clearly times in psychophysiology where we do manipulate physiology and look at the impact on behavior, not doing so usually through such drastic means as this, but through things like biofeedback, for example, training people to alter muscle tension, cardiovascular responses, and seeing the impact on their behavior or their health or their experience. Okay, and so after all this, he still concludes, "I wish our editor the best of luck in defining the scope of articles acceptable for our journal," noting even at that point that this was just a starting point and probably going to be a little bit tricky. Okay. Now, jump ahead quite a few years, And in your current handbook, Cassiope, Tassinari, and Bernson, in the introductory chapter, say that psychophysiology is the scientific study of social, psychological, and behavioral phenomena as related to and revealed through physiological principles and events in functional organisms. So they're taking a broader view. They're not necessarily saying that either the physiology or the psychology is the independent or dependent variable. Could be either in this. They're very strong on linking it to physiological principles and linking it to theory. Okay? And of course, functional organisms. So this is not post-mortem kinds of study. We're interested in obviously how this works in intact organisms. But organisms leaves open the possibility that psychophysiologists wouldn't study only humans, although historically that's been really what psychophysiologists typically study. Okay. And I thought I'd just jump into this too. So here's my definition at this very moment. So I would say that psychophysiology, trying to be broad here, is the use of a particular set of physiologically based, dependent or independent variables that will let us gain insights into psychological questions. So that would be psychological states, psychological phenomena, and individual differences that are interesting psychologically, things like psychopathology, for example. And when done well, or when used wisely, psychophysiological methods can provide an independent method for something that's been studied another way. So, for example, a reaction time finding might be robust and replicable across many different studies. But if you have another independent measure that confirms or substantiates the data to date, it becomes another part of the construct validity of the topic under investigation. And perhaps an especially useful way to use psychophysiological measures is that they can provide information that's not accessible through other psychological methods. Okay? So there are, for example, populations that are going to be unable to report very accurately their experience. Infants, people with dementia, for example. Okay? There may also be certain kinds of psychological processes that none of us can report particularly accurately. They occur too fast or outside of reflective awareness, so we may need some other kind of objective measure like psychophysiological measures to try to get a handle on them. So a couple of the examples that I'll talk about today will deal with some examining phenomenon that people were not able to provide an accurate report about, and yet the psychophysiological measures seem to be useful. Okay. Now, psychophysiology can be distinguished, albeit with some fuzzy boundaries, from things like physiological psychology and behavioral neuroscience. So physiological psychology was really what John Stern was trying to distinguish. That was using brain lesions, brain stimulation, drug administration, manipulating the physiology and looking at its impact on behavior in animals for the most part. And that's kind of classic physiological psychology. And behavioral neuroscience is certainly an area that overlaps with psychophysiology. And I think you might be hard-pressed sometimes to say with great confidence it's one or the other, and you might get people disagreeing about it. But if you had to try to draw some distinctions between psychophysiology on the one hand and behavioral neuroscience on the other, it might deal with level of analysis. Psychophysiologists are interested in the broader system, linking across multiple levels of analysis, from brain activity to experience to social phenomena. Okay. Another difference potentially is that often in behavioral neuroscience, localization is really paramount. It's one of the key things that they're after. And in psychophysiology, that's not the only thing that psychophysiologists are after. There are ways in which psychophysiological measures can inform theory in psychological research that don't depend on a strict localization. And even when localization is important, the level of analysis still differs somewhat, with behavioral neuroscience usually focusing more on the cell level or the genetic level, and psychophysiologists focusing on the level of neural systems. So you can think of it as kind of how broad the lens of inquiry is, and psychophysiology is going to have a little broader lens than traditional behavioral neuroscience. And Cassiope, Tassinari, and Bernson also say in their first chapter that psychophysiology focuses more often on higher cognitive processes, integrating cognitive processes with autonomic nervous system, whereas behavioral neuroscience will focus more on lower-level processes in isolation. Yes?
For psychophysiological psychology and psychophysiology, are you distinguishing those, or are you just saying that?
No, yes, I am. So I'm saying, actually, the distinction between physiological psychology and psychophysiology is probably pretty clear compared to the distinction between behavioral neuroscience and psychophysiology. So just to back up 1 second, John Stern's table back here, this was between physiological psychology and psychophysiology. Okay? And so kind of classic physiological psychology that's been going on for 100 years working with animals is pretty well defined, and psychophysiology is quite different than that. But the modern variant of physiological psychology, behavioral neuroscience, is clearly a broader field and is going to overlap with psychology.
So does that still exist then?
Yes. Yeah. People probably don't call themselves physiological psychologists as much anymore. They call themselves behavioral neuroscientists or neuroscientists. And I, you know, if you talk to behavioral neuroscientists, they might even tell you I'm painting an unduly narrow view of their field. And there are probably people who say they're behavioral neuroscientists who come to the meeting psychophysiology and publish in the journal psychophysiology. So there's clearly overlap. But if you had to say how they're different, you know, that's probably what I would go with. The other difference potentially between both of these, physiological psychology, behavioral neuroscience on the one hand, psychophysiology on the other, might be in terms of invasiveness. Human psychophysiology historically is quite non-invasive. We record signals from outside the body. We rarely go under the skin, would even less often go under the skull, for example. Not that it doesn't happen, but it's much less often. Okay. Now, in terms of the scope of psychophysiology, there's a series of classic measures, things that have been part of psychophysiology for a very long time, almost since its inception nearly 50 years ago. So we have things like skin conductance responses and skin conductance levels, the amount of sweat going on at the palms of the hands or the palms of the feet. Cardiac measures, and there are numerous ones here, it's not an exhaustive list, heart rate variability, cardiac contractility, sympathetic nervous system, parasympathetic nervous system measures of cardiac function, blood pressure, plethysmography, which is measuring of the blood as it goes through the capillary bed. So it'll all be kind of classic measures. Ocular motor and pupillometric measures, looking at eye movements and the contraction of the muscles that close the pupil. EMG, muscle activity, respiration. There's an entire line of research that I've never engaged in, gastrointestinal activity, the EGG, the electrogastrogram. There's a chapter on it. It's a big area of inquiry. There's also sexual plethysmography that's used. Most of that work ends up being done with sex offenders in an applied context these days, although not exclusively. And then there's a variety of EEG-related activity, brain electrical activity. That can be oscillatory measures. How fast do we see oscillations in the brain at any given time, and how does that relate to states? We also, for example, sleep psychophysiology being an example of that. We can also see event-related brain potentials, changes in voltage as a function of time. We can also see event-related frequency changes, changes in the frequency of oscillation as a function of events. So all of these would be kind of classic measures. And there's a series of newer measures that some people don't traditionally associate with psychophysiology, but I would make the statement that these are, in fact, psychophysiological measures. They have research followings that don't traditionally define themselves as psychophysiologists, but nonetheless, they share a lot in common with them. So these would include hormonal and endocrinological measures, immune function measures, things we would lump under functional neuroimaging, which are really measures of brain metabolism or blood flow within the brain, and there's several of those, and magnetoencephalography, looking at the magnetic fields generated by the brain, which would be a complement to the electrical fields of the brain with EEG. So these are all clearly psychophysiological measures as well, but you may not see them traditionally defined that way. And then there are even manipulations that I think we could think of as psychophysiological measures. So classical biofeedback studies were based upon somebody's physiological responses, say their muscle tone. They will hear higher or lower tones, or they will see brighter or dimmer lights. People can get feedback about their physiological function. That's a psychophysiological paradigm. And more recently, rapid transcranial magnetic stimulation. where you take a very small device that generates a very potent and localized magnetic field, you can disrupt neural function or stimulate it depending on the frequency. So it's another technique for manipulating physiological response and looking at its impact in terms of psychological experience. Yes?
Can you do that in the U.S.?
You can do it in the U.S. You have to often have a physician on hand. Okay. If you wouldn't want to get the, you know, the voltage or the, you know, the settings wrong on it. Okay. It's used therapeutically for depression in experimental contexts, looking at using it over the left frontal cortex. It's also used in experiments where you're interested in whether or not a particular region of cortex is important for a particular kind of information processing or response. And right at the time that the person's supposed to process the information or make the response, you turn on the device, and if they can't respond, suggest that's an important part of the circuit mediating that response. So clearly there's a lot of measures, and this probably is not an exhaustive list, but it covers a lot of the different things. So we'll spend a bit of time covering many of these and some of these. And I'll say a little bit about biofeedback as well. Okay. So this is just a table that's designed to help you think about different areas of psychology. So if you look at your book by Cacioppo, Tassinari, and Bernson, there's a bunch of what we call systemic chapters. So you read about the galvanic skin response system, you read about the cardiovascular system, you read about the skeletomotor system. So you walk through system by system. And then later they have thematic chapters, which are kind of integrating across systems and dealing with different kinds of themes. And so one way you could think about this is that, you know, any kind of research could fit into at least one, if not several, of these cells. So across the top, we have different kind of traditional areas and departments of psychology, but all of whom are psychophysiologists. You've got cognitive psychophysiologists, developmental psychophysiologists, clinical, social, and applied psychophysiologists. So if, you know, one was to devise a new department from scratch of all psychophysiologists, you could just, you know, think about having lots of different areas. And then in any of these areas, people could use measures that cut across a variety of different systems. So we have electrodermal, cardiovascular, electroencephalographic, electromyographic, hemodynamic, which would include things like PET or BOLD, for example, fMRI. So, for example, traditional studies of lie detection are an applied kind of psychophysiology that tend to use electrodermal responses. If we're interested in cardiovascular effects of prejudice and how that might affect people's health outcomes, that's clearly using cardiovascular system, but might span social and clinical psychophysiology. If we're interested in EEG asymmetry effects in kids who are temperamentally extremely inhibited or pathologically shy, then that would span clinical and developmental psychology using EEG measures. And of course, you don't have to span just in this direction. We could also, for example, look at fMRI linked to particular emotional experience, and we define those emotional experiences based upon something like autonomic responses, like skin conductance responses. So there we would be linking across hemodynamic psychophysiology like fMRI, electrodermal physiology such as skin conductance responses, and if we're interested in just kind of basic emotion, I've put that under cognitive psychophysiology, although maybe you'd want to have a separate cognitive and emotional group if you were so inclined. But to kind of help you think about that, there's a lot of different ways in which psychophysiological research is used. Okay. So one of the problems, though, is what can we reasonably say when we observe a physiological response in an experiment involving individual differences or some psychological manipulation? If things are related, we can clearly say without too much objection that we have a correlate. There's some physiological change correlates with some psychological change, or physiological differences seem to map onto psychological differences between people. But a substrate is a level of inference that's a lot tougher to substantiate. So we have to ask whether or not any observed physiological change is actually tapping a substrate of behavior. And my bold caveat here is that we need to beware. This is a very hard thing to say that we actually have found. And I'll show you in a minute, there's lots of examples in the literature where people claim to have substrates when really they haven't done anything that would convince me or many people that they have. Okay. So if you really wanted to say, I have a physiological substrate of phenomenon X, or experience X, or behavior X, we'd have to say that that physiological activity is somehow necessary for that behavior or experience to occur, and without it, it wouldn't occur. Okay? So if we could remove it, which would probably require things like lesions or transcranial magnetic stimulation, then would behavior be altered in a predictable way? In that case, we might be much closer to being able to say it really is a substrate. It's a necessary component underlying that behavior. But in many times, the things that we're measuring are clearly going to be correlates. It doesn't mean that they're not useful, and they may help us inform theory, but we shouldn't necessarily think that just because it's physiological, therefore it somehow is a substrate. It's a necessary feature that underlies behavior. Now, people usually don't make this mistake with certain kinds of measures. So when they see a skin conductance response, they don't say, oh, that's the substrate of emotion. You know, because, you know, people without hands can feel emotion, right? People with spinal cord injuries can feel emotion. So people don't make those kinds of mistakes. But oftentimes they don't have any better evidence other than whatever measure they had happened inside the brain. They say, ah, and it happened in a part of the brain that I thought would be important, so therefore it's a substrate of behavior. But I hope you see it's no different. It's just a correlate at that level, and you'd have to do some further work to be able to really be sure that what you're observing is a necessary and sufficient feature for the behavior to occur. Okay. So ultimately, this is not really that easily resolved. Okay? And it's not unique to any one method. You see this in magnetoencephalography and functional magnetic resonance imaging and EEG. You see it in all these different fields. People will want to think that they have a substrate, but they may just have a correlate. We'll come back to this in a couple different ways as well. Okay. Oh, this is a quote that came out of the first chapter that I particularly like. It said, written now 70 years ago, a scientific theory is a description of causal interrelations. Psychophysiological correlations are not causal. Thus, in scientific theory, psychophysiological correlations are monstrosities. That's a little bit of a strong statement, I hope, but it doesn't mean they have no part in science. They are the instruments by which the psychologist may test his theories. And now, 70 years later, she may test her theories as well. Okay. All right, so in terms of the problems of inference, I want to take a couple of the concepts that were listed in the Cacioppo, Tassinari, and Bernson chapter and just review them here. This is a figure that comes from their 2000 edition of the chapter. They took out for this edition of the chapter, but I still think it's kind of useful because they just mention this in passing in the chapter. So what they lay out is the idea that there are different ways in which psychological phenomena, some aspect of experience, for example, are related to physiological phenomena, activity in some system, for example. Now, if everything were a simple one-to-one world, we wouldn't have any real inference problem because this psychological experience depends on this physiological activity, and this physiological activity only gives rise to this psychological experience. And if everything were like that, you know, we'd probably be done by now. But it's not. So, so this would be ideal, for example, if, you know, when I feel happy, there's activity in this physiological system, when I feel sad in this system, and when I'm angry in this system. Of course, it's not, you know, so simple as that. Now, there's also one-to-many kinds of relationships where more than one physiological system gives rise to a particular psychological experience. So you can imagine, when I'm afraid, I can think of at least a couple of physiological kinds of responses that'll be going on. My heart rate may be increased, my blood pressure may be increased, my skin conductance may be up, my palms are sweaty, just to name a few. In that case, you've got, one psychological experience, but multiple physiological systems. Many to one here, here we have a particular physiological system, but it's that same response can be involved in more than one psychological experience. So, for example, an increase in heart rate might be related to anger, an increase in heart rate might be related to fear. We're going to feel it in both of those cases. So just seeing an increase in heart rate wouldn't let me know necessarily what psychological state I was observing. This is probably the real world here, many to many. So, many different systems contribute to many different psychological experiences or behaviors, and there are probably some combination of these that contribute to each, but it's not going to be easy to ferret out. Okay. Now, Only these two types of relationships here, many-to-one and one-to-one, will actually allow you to have some formal specification that some psychological elements, in other words, experience or behavior, psychological experience or behavior, are a function of specific physiological elements. So what you really want to do is be able to find one of these things, and if you can't find one of these things, try to do some additional experiments to reduce the complexity of your data. And they had some suggestions that in concept are simple, but in practice are hard. And so this was also only in their 2000 edition of the chapter, but I thought it was pretty useful, so I brought it back for this lecture. Here's the idea. You start out with some complicated set of relationships, but over time, you can end up with by reducing them to one-to-one relationships by redefining what you call a physiological response. Okay. So, here, for example, we have this psychological phenomenon that requires a pattern of responses in two systems. So if we now say, well, that pattern of responses is the physiological response, now it's a one-to-one. Okay? So we're now, when we go from A here, which is individual response systems, to B, which is response patterns, then we can now say this is a unique psychological event that correlates with a physiological response pattern that is unique as well. So now when you have that kind of relationship, you can say, well, if I have this behavior, then I have this physiological response pattern. If I have this physiological response pattern, then I have this behavior. And, of course, when things get more complicated, even that may not be sufficient all the time. So then, this is where I think the hand-waving comes in a little bit, is you say, well, how about if we look at the pattern over time? Okay, so that pattern changes in time in a unique way. It'd be great if you can find it. I mean, it's easy to think about in theory. It's much harder to find. But if we see, for example, that you know the arousal that's engendered by some emotion resolves over time in a unique way for one emotion and a different way for another emotion, then that breaks down to a one-to-one relationship. Okay. So the way you reduce the complexity is what do you call a physiological response? In the simplest version of this, it's activity in some physiological system. In the next step, it's a pattern across systems. And in the final step, it's a pattern across systems across time. And so it allows you to be more specific in terms of what you mean by a physiological response. Okay. So the typical scenarios we see in psychophysiological, behavioral neuroscience, physiological psychology kinds of research is that typically you have some study where you measure physiology as a function of some behavior or experience. And what you're trying to say then is that the probability of finding this physiological response given this behavior or experience is greater than zero. In other words, I have a significant relationship when I measure physiology in the context of this behavior or experience. So given psychological phenomenon, I will find that physiological response. So when people do an episodic memory task, I see activity in one region. When they do a semantic memory task, I see activity in another region. Okay? Those would be examples of that. When people feel scared, I see that they have responses on the palms of their skin. Okay? So those would be examples of this kind of phenomenon. Now, other studies will have a different structure, like a biofeedback study, and that is, given a particular physiological response, which I'm manipulating, I should see some psychological change. Okay? So if I reduce sympathetic nervous system arousal, if I increase parasympathetic nervous system function, I should see generally some calming experience psychologically. Okay? And so that should be, again, the greater than zero is just their way of saying significant relationship. These things will occur. Now, oftentimes we're hunting for markers or substrates, and so the hunt begins with the first kind of study. We find some physiological response as a function of a psychological variable. Schizophrenics differ from non-schizophrenics in terms of their deviant eye tracking, for example. Okay. And that's a reliable effect. But then, the desirable but often invalid inference is, well then if I see the physiological measure, it must mean that I have, that goes with that psychological phenomenon. It's a marker of that. Deviant eye tracking is a marker of schizophrenia, for example. Okay. And in this particular case, that's actually a reasonably valid inference. But, you know, we could also, you'll see a couple of studies I'll show you in a minute, of fMRI studies of rather complex phenotypes, things like religious experience. Say, given religious experience, I see activity in particular regions of the brain, therefore, those regions of the brain must be the substrate of that experience, okay? That's where we start to get into trouble. It's only valid given a one-to-one relationship of the psychological and physiological element in the study.
So how would that be one-to-one then? Because it wouldn't make sense if you said all schizophrenics have one deviant eye track, right?
So it's a pattern of how their eyes track a moving target. Okay, and then you quantify this deviant eye tracking in a very particular way.
So it works the other way then too, like off.
So if it's never all, but it's close. So many schizophrenics, mm-hmm. and in fact many relatives of people with schizophrenia show this deviant eye tracking. Mm-hmm. And that deviant eye tracking is also relatively specific to schizophrenia, although you can get poor eye tracking with other kinds of neuromuscular disorders. But it's closer to one-to-one than many of these things, then you could say, okay, this may actually be some kind of a marker of not just schizophrenia, but risk for schizophrenia. Okay. Now, unfortunately, when we get to the level of brain activations, you know, rarely, I think, is the brain set up so that a piece of cortex does one and only one thing. It wouldn't be a particularly good design evolutionarily. And so these regions of brain subserve many different functions, so making these kinds of inferences can get really quite complex. Okay. Now, what you can do is try to use some complementary approaches. So you start out with a typical non-invasive kind of study, and you find some activation in a region of the brain, a physiological response, as a function of some psychological variable, attention, memory, for example. And then you do a lesion study. And that could be actually lesioning brains actively as an experimental manipulation, or in humans, you would usually find people with naturally occurring lesions in that particular region. And then you see, given that deficit in physiology, do they show a deficit in the psychological construct you're interested in? So then if you see both of those, then that goes a lot farther to helping you make this kind of claim that this is a physiological substrate for the behavior of interest. Okay. The last piece of this that's kind of complex comes right out of your book, and I just wanted to go over it again because every time I go back to this chapter, they change the figure every time they revise the book. The concept's the same, and it's really a neat construct, but it's kind of complicated. So they've divided the world into a couple of different axes in terms of one-to-one or many-to-one relationships and whether you find it in only specific contexts or it's in any context. Oh, we need to stop for the tape? Okay. Give you a chance to digest the figure. Okay, thanks. All right, so probably the place we usually start is with an outcome. And it's a pretty generic term. And an outcome is going to be a many-to-one relationship, so many different psychological phenomena may map onto a physiological response, so that's the many-to-one, and it's usually measured in some particular context. So we could look at, for example, people's expected experience and measure their heart rate changes using a well-known paradigm, using the International Affect Picture Series. We'll talk more about that later, but these are pictures that have been characterized in terms of being unpleasant or pleasant and various levels of arousal. So you show people spiders, snakes, mutilation scenes, disaster scenes for unpleasant, and you show them happy things like people skiing and puppies and babies and things like that. And there are certain physiological responses that may go along with different affect, but they're not unique to that affect. You may see those responses in other affects. So for example, heart rate may increase with both positive and negative affect, at least initially. Okay, and this is seen just in a specific paradigm. So at this point, is there an inference warranted given that we have a physiological response? No. Right. Heart rate increase wouldn't tell us anything about what emotion is being experienced. Okay. This is certainly a good starting point, but before we could make an inference about the physiological response being necessary, sufficient, or a substrate, we'd have to do a lot more work. Okay. Now, in terms of markers, these are things that are in fact a one-to-one relationship, but are context dependent. So the best example of this is medical tests, like cholesterol testing. So in order to have a valid measure of your cholesterol profile, you have to have a fasting cholesterol. So if after an overnight fast, you go in and have your cholesterol taken and it's high, then that's probably a valid indicator of you having hyperlipidemia. Okay? So then if high cholesterol on the test, then hyperlipidemia is present. Okay, that'd be the inference you could have. But it is context dependent. You know, if you had steak for breakfast, then probably all bets are off on the validity of the test. But markers are clearly useful. You just have to control the circumstances in order to get valid results. Now, concomitants are many-to-one context-free relationships. You'll see them in all kinds of different contexts, but lots of different psychological phenomena map onto the same physiological response. So, for example, arousal and skin conductance. When people feel aroused or anxious, they're going to show skin conductance increases or skin conductance responses. They'll start sweating on their palms. So again, there's no inference you can make given that you see this pattern of physiology, sweaty palms. Okay, they could be anxious, they could be in a hot room, you know, there could be a variety of different things that are going on. And then finally here we have the holy grail of psychophysiological research. And that is a context-free one-to-one relationship, so that this physiological index relates only to this psychological index and vice versa, and you can see it in any context. And I thought about this a while. In fact, I was kind of perplexed that in the book they didn't offer examples. So the only one I could come up with was the IT15, which stands for Interesting Transcription 15, and it's a genetic variant at the end of the short arm of chromosome 4 that is the definitive test for somebody carrying the Huntington's gene. And of course, if they live long enough, they will develop Huntington's disease. So it doesn't matter what context you get it in, I guess as long as you've got a valid, you know, sample of blood or saliva. If it's present, then Huntington's will at some point be present. Okay, so it's context-free in that sense. They didn't have to be fasting, they didn't have to be, you know, well-rested or anything like that. And there's a one-to-one relationship because IT15 shouldn't relate to other things. And Huntington's isn't caused by other things. So if we had, you know, other variants that looked like Huntington's caused by, say, an environmental insult, then this, you know, wouldn't be a good example. Okay. Now, it's complex, but what I think the take-home message here is you really want to be careful about things that you might be finding up here on the top of the figure and mistakenly inferring that they're things that you think are on the bottom of the figure. Okay. So getting things that are on the top of the figure are fairly easy to do. You run an experiment and you see a physiological result. Getting things on the bottom of the figure are harder to find, where a specific physiological response pattern over time relates to a psychological phenomenon or individual difference. Okay. So we have to be careful. You'll see many claims for things that are down here, but the evidence may only warrant claims that are up here. This is the substrate. Okay. This is a really, really reliable correlate, and these are just correlates. Okay. All right, so a couple examples of the inference problem. So here's an article, came out in 1993, entitled Religious and Mystical States, a Neuropsychological Substrate. Okay. So here's the substrate of religious and mystical experience. Okay. So they had SPECT images, and This stands for single photon emission computed tomography. It's like PET scanning, except it has lower resolution, so you can see these brains look a tad fuzzy. It involves a small dose of radioactive isotopes, and then you measure where the activity is going on in the brain based upon the radioactivity given off. And so here we have people at baseline, and here they're meditating. And these individuals, as I recall, were practice meditators who also would meditate and have religious and mystical experiences. And they just indicated when they were in such a state, and it's not a dramatic effect, but you can see there's more frontal activity here than here. You see there's, like, you know, bigger gaps and stuff. There's more activity here in the frontal lobes when people are experiencing religious or meditative states, okay, or mystical states. Now, we don't know that it's a substrate. Can people with frontal lobe damage still have mystical or religious experiences? My guess is they might be able to, in which case we couldn't say it's a substrate. Okay. And of course, the other thing with this methodology, and we'll unpack this later when we talk about functional neuroimaging, this comparison assumes the only thing that's different between these two conditions is the presence of the religious and mystical state here versus here. But between baseline and doing anything, yeah, there's going to be a lot of other differences as well. The amount of effort, the amount of attention, the general level of arousal, just to name a few. So I'm not even sure we could say that this is in any way specific to these states. Okay. That was a pretty easy one to identify, you know, a problem, because it's a bold claim without a lot of good evidence. Okay, so this one, I think, is an improvement, but it's still just an outcome. It's not a substrate. But at least they say neural correlates of religious experience. Okay, and so in this study, they had different tasks. They had a religious task, which was reciting the first verse of Psalm 23. And then they had a control task, which was reciting a German children's nursery rhyme. These were German subjects, so it wasn't otherwise weird. So they did, you know, Psalm 23 in German and this nursery rhyme in German. And then they had neutral, where they were looking at the instructions on a phone card from the Deutsche Telekom phone book. So you do these contrasts, and of course some things light up. Some things are different between the conditions. And what they'd like to say then is this is a correlate of religious experience. And I guess, you know, you say it is a correlate, right? I guess the reason I want to bring it up as an example, though, is, you know, when you see these, people want to infer, this is, you know, substrate for religious experience. This is a necessary component of religious experience. But there may be, again, many other things that are different between reciting Psalm 23 and the kids' nursery rhyme. Okay. It's a reasonable control. They tried, because both were very familiar to people in Germany, but we don't know that they're equally familiar, you know, for example. Okay. All right, one more example. This one. One brain, two selves. It's a study of dissociative identity disorder, multiple personality disorder.
I have a question about the...
Oh, sure.
I wonder, did they actually define what they meant by experience?
Let's see. Oops. I don't have enough information to tell you that. These people were self-identified as religious subjects, okay, and they did this religious recitation that they said would give them a religious experience. Okay. And one of the claims they make, oops, I went back too far. One of the claims they make, which I guess I think is quite reasonable, so they see these areas here, the specific areas not being important for making this point, that religious experience may be a cognitive process which nonetheless feels immediate. So they're not making a claim of like a special center for religious experience. Okay. So. And I think they're appropriately cautious in how they bill it. Okay. This last one. So this one is a study of DID, dissociative identity disorder. It used to be known as multiple personality disorder. And this is where one individual has distinct identities that have amnesia between at least some identities, don't know what other identities are up to. And they have their own specific way of looking at themselves and the world and relating to the world. So you know, you probably have seen movies or read books about this kind of condition. Okay, it's popularized quite well. So the idea in this study was, well, how about if we look at different identities, and may they show different pattern of brain activation? And they went one step further drawing from some literature that will speculate that early repeated childhood trauma is related to the development of DID, they had both traumatic scripts and non-traumatic scripts. So they have a personality who shouldn't be particularly affected by trauma and a personality who should. So they've got a non-traumatic personality and a traumatic personality. And then they have a script that the person is going over, hearing, that is either traumatic or non-traumatic. Okay? And they want to see if specifically there's some different way in which the trauma-relevant personality handles trauma-related material. And I'll come back to this conclusion in just a moment. And they do find that. In fact, there's many brain regions. In fact, you can see there's quite a few here. But the general pattern of findings is replicated across several areas where non-traumatic personalities, no matter whether they're looking at non-traumatic material or traumatic material, so NPS is non-traumatic personality state, N is neutral, and then non-traumatic personality state with trauma material, traumatic personality state with neutral material, and traumatic personality state with trauma material. The important thing is it's only this last group. When the trauma personality encounters traumatic material, that there's a big change in regional cerebral blood flow here in this sample area up in the frontal cortex, but in many other areas it replicates. Okay, so that's a very interesting correlate, clearly, that it's not just that these people in general handle traumatic material differently, that traumatic personality handles it differently, but here's their conclusion. Our data confirm the emergence of conscious versus unconscious experience in the neural network of superior and inferior parietal lobule left occipital cortex, precuneum, the frontal brain areas, including these two Brodmann areas. Okay. Something about conscious or unconscious experience that they've really tested there. Okay. So they've made some fairly strong claims, and one of the difficulties with these kinds of studies is that they start to suggest if you see different patterns of brain activation in the brain, that somehow de facto means that the different personalities are, you know, clearly real or clearly different than you might see in people without the disorder. You know, one kind of thing you'd have to do in a study like this is get people who are quite imaginative and have them simulate different identities, for example. Would you also see that they show the same pattern? If so, you know, there's nothing specific or unique about this. If they couldn't, then that would go a little further to suggesting, well, this is something, you know, fairly specific about this paradigm. And so then if we would go back to our model, then it's going to be context dependent, okay, and maybe it would even become a marker, but there'd be a lot of work before that would have to be done. Right now, it's just an outcome. Okay. All right, so we'll take a break in just a minute here, but what I want to end with for the first part of today's lecture is just a couple of the problems and challenges for psychophysiology and a couple of the great prospects for psychophysiology as a discipline. Okay. So in terms of the problems and challenges, we've talked a little bit, well, we talked more than a little bit, about the interpretive ambiguity. Okay, this is going to be something we need to continue to wrestle with, and you know, it's job security, if nothing else. Now, another issue that I haven't really mentioned but will come up throughout the course is that the time course of different systems is dramatically different from one another. And as we're interested in linking from brain activity to autonomic responses, for example, we may see things that respond on very different time courses. Brain electrical activity may occur on the course of milliseconds, but the hemodynamic response changes that you measure with fMRI would occur lagged by seconds. In terms of the response on the autonomic side, some changes can respond quite quickly, like changes in heart rate can respond within a second, but changes in skin conductance responding might not change until a few seconds later as well. So trying to line up these responses across systems could be somewhat tricky. Another issue with psychophysiology, because we're interested in measuring across different systems, is different kinds of measures have different spatial resolutions as well. Functional magnetic resonance imaging can have very precise spatial localization, so we know right where the blood flow changes have occurred in the brain. We don't know exactly when they occurred, but we know right where they occurred. On the other hand, EEG has relatively poor spatial localization. It's not, we can't say definitively where the electrical activity originates from, and even though we can model where it might be coming from, we can't do so with the same precision that we do with fMRI. So again, we have another kind of problem in terms of mapping different response systems to presumably the same genesis, the same originating structures or systems in the brain. Also, there's some activity that, depending how you look at it, it's good or bad, you can pick it up everywhere, and so it's not well localized. The heart rate, the EKG, the electrical activity of the heart, is picked up throughout the body. And as a result, you know, you'll get it, if you're not careful, in your EEG, you'll get it in your EMG, you can get it using any system that you want. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily muscle activity, it's cardiac activity, so you have to be a little bit careful about that. And then I think ultimately, and this is where careers can be spent, is trying to determine what's the functional significance of the physiological response that you see in your psychological paradigm of interest. What does it really mean? What is it telling us? What's the theoretical significance and what's the construct validity? So we'll come back to that when we get to different response systems in terms of talking about what we think the constructs are that may be tapped by different experimental protocols. Okay, but there's plenty of prospects for psychophysiology as well, and so just a few of them. It's clearly non-invasive, at least compared to many of the other kinds of physiological responses, so it's ideally suited for human research. It's ideally suited for non-patient research. So when patients have, you know, conditions that may be life-threatening, it may be ethically justified to do more invasive kinds of procedures, but you know, for the 101 subject pool, it's just not justified. We need to have something that's non-invasive. This is a widely available, easy to use, non-invasive technique. You know, the only invasiveness is people get some gel or goop on their skin or their hair. It's not, you know, really that bad. Yeah.
So do MRIs and fMRIs count for this?
Sure, because they're quite non-invasive, right, as well. And certain people can't do it because they may have metal in their body if they've had a surgical procedure. If they were a welder, they might have metal flakes in their eyes and things like that. But it's you can do it repeatedly without any increased risk. Other things are kind of in the middle. Positron emission tomography involves injecting radioactivity. It's a small amount, and I'm told it's the amount you get on a transcontinental airline flight just by going up, you know, into the atmosphere that high. But it's a little more invasive. Okay. All right. Now, what's also really nice, I think, about psychophysiological measures is that you're not measuring some delayed or voluntary response over time. You're not, you know, like a reaction time. You're not having people tell you what they did after the fact. You're measuring real-time information. You're looking at things as they happen. It might make it less likely that the information you're getting is altered in some way by people's pre-existing conceptions of how they should respond. So if you tell people, how angry were you during that experiment? They might feel, well, I probably shouldn't have been that angry, even though I was. You know, they may downplay what they were feeling, but if you've got measures of cardiovascular activity and skin conductance response and, you know, facial flushing, maybe you could see the fact that they were quite angry in real time. Also, it might be sensitive to things that we ourselves cannot be sensitive to. There are just certain kinds of things that happen too fast for us to be able to report them. Okay? People who study vision, for example. Lots of things happen before we're actually aware of the visual stimulus. I've also mentioned, for example, there are certain patient populations that may not be aware of certain things, so we could use that. And there's that ubiquitous cognitive deficit we all outgrow childhood, where people aren't necessarily able to report validly on their experience, and so again, you may be able to use this to be sensitive to things that couldn't be provided by self-report. Okay. Along that line, it's ideally suited for populations that have limited verbal or cognitive capacity. And one of the things I like about psychophysiological measures is that they do allow bridging across multiple levels of analysis. And so they're a level below behavior, and they're a level above, say, single unit recording. And they might allow us to link across different levels of analysis. You know, one of the, I think, the real exciting things with psychophysiology right now is, you know, the human genome is mapped. So we know what all these genes are. But now there's a huge construct validity problem. What does this gene do? Right? And people can try to link it to broad phenotypes like depression. And there clearly are genes that, you know, in some studies anyway, look like they might be related in ways to how people respond to stress or may develop depression. But that's a pretty broad and heterogeneous phenotype to study. So maybe we could link it instead to some psychophysiological response in a particular context that might get at a more homogeneous set of individuals, and that might then become a way to link genes to psychophysiology to some subset of behavior. On the other end of the spectrum, you know, trying to link responses to social stress to genes would probably be very difficult to do without using something like psychophysiological measures. Mm-hmm. Not that it can't be done, but it would be probably aided. So you can really link across these different levels of analysis. So if you take a biopsychosocial perspective, psychophysiology is a very good one, a very good tool for you. Also, in terms of the increase in papers and studies using psychophysiology, this has really mushroomed over the last decade. So you start to see psychophysiological measures appearing in non-specialty journals. By that I mean journals that aren't traditionally affiliated with psychophysiological responses or physiological responses. You'll see psychophysiology in the Journal of Social and Personality Psychology. You'll see them in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology. You'll see them in the Journal of Clinical and Consulting Psychology. So you see them in all kinds of different journals that don't necessarily think of themselves as a psychophysiology journal. So I think that's very exciting. And along those lines, psychophysiology has become much more accessible to people than it was, say, a few decades ago. A few decades ago, most psychophysiologists were kind of a stereotypic breed of people who really liked to tinker with electronics, and they needed to have a penchant for that. They had their volt ohm meters and they're probably even the pocket protectors, and they would be wiring things in their lab and they'd be mixing their electrode paste. And this was, you know, the origins of our field and a lot of important work in terms of how those circuits should work and what kinds of gel should be used for different things. But now some of those problems have been worked out, and you know, we live in a great capitalistic society where people are trying to sell us stuff, and so now many people can buy for a reasonable price systems that are capable of collecting good psychophysiological data, and you can do it then without being a specialist. Now, a plug for people like me, of course, you know, people are new to this, they need advice and consultations, so as you get your training in psychophysiology, you may also have some role in providing advice and consultation for people as well. Okay. And you know, everything I've said, I think, should pertain to all psychophysiological measures, but drawing a distinction between the so-called newer and potentially more expensive technologies and the traditional psychophysiological measures, these traditional psychophysiological measures still provide lots of information that might not suggest you need to jump right away to the more expensive technology. There's excellent real-time resolution of these measures, things like EEG. Okay? It's a flexible, cost-effective approach to recording signals. It can be integrated with many of these newer technologies. I think one of the most interesting things to come down the road is people looking at linking events in fMRI studies to patterns of psychophysiological response. So we're not linking it just to a response with a button or just to an a priori categorization of stimuli, learned and unlearned, but instead linking it to people's physiological response. Okay. And as I've said before, these measures can be integrated across different response systems to help us understand more of the organism as a whole. Okay. All right. And the final thing, and this can be handy for some people, you have this problem when you tell people you study psychology, they want to start telling you everything, so you just tell them, I'm a psychophysiologist, and then they usually leave you alone because they parse that as psycho, which is kind of weird or mad, and physiologist, some kind of scientist, and they think you're a mad scientist, and you'll have the rest of the airplane ride to yourself. All right. So this is probably a good time for a break, and so what we'll do is, I guess we'll take 12 minutes. And we'll come back and we'll talk about a few select studies that might be of interest.
I'm sorry, what time?
11 minutes, 51 seconds. All right. Just this, you can go. All right. So the last bit of this first lecture is just to give you a sampling of some of the literature, and it's a huge literature, so this is not in any way intended to be a representative nor random sample, but things that I thought were kind of interesting, and hopefully, without a lot of background in psychophysiology, can be pretty easily apprehended in terms of you seeing the utility and excitement of psychophysiology. So The first study that I'm going to talk about is one that I encountered in graduate school and changed the direction of my professional career. So I'll give you a brief, psychophysiologist anonymous disclosure here. So I was an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and they didn't have psychophysiology going on at the time I was there, which was unusual because they had a long and distinguished tradition of psychophysiology. The psychophysiologists had left. But my last year there, in came this moving van full of big electronic equipment, which got me pretty excited. It's kind of like, you know, a hot rod car coming up, except with electronic equipment in a moving van. And a professor, assistant professor Richie Davidson, had just been hired at the University of Wisconsin. And I read a couple of psychophysiological studies. They seemed pretty interesting to me. And so I begged and pleaded for him to let me into his class. And I guess I was enough of a pest that he did, because it was a graduate course and I got in as an undergraduate. And I was working at the time on some projects related to risk for psychosis with Lauren and Jean Chapman. So I got excited about psychophysiology, and I went to graduate school thinking I was going to study psychophysiology of risk for schizophrenia and psychosis. And I applied places where that was possible, including the University of Minnesota, which is where I did my work. So I got to the University of Minnesota, and during my first semester there, I joined the Neuropsychology Journal Club, and we were a fun bunch that read articles in neuropsychology. But one of the articles was this one that I'm going to talk about, and it really got me interested in using psychophysiological measures to study phenomena that may be outside of people's general awareness. And so it changed what I was thinking about doing, and I never did publish anything in schizophrenia after my time in Wisconsin, so it really changed my view of things. We'll talk about a few other studies here. This is just the list of things that we'll get to. So this is a study by Russ Bauer. He's at the University of Florida, appeared in Neuropsychologia in 1984. And it's a study looking at the condition known as prosopagnosia. Prosopagnosia is fortunately a rare neurological condition. It results from bilateral damage in the association cortices at the intersection of the parietal, occipital, and temporal lobes. And phenomenologically, it results in an inability to identify people by face. So someone with prosopagnosia will see somebody that they've known their whole life, sibling, for example, somebody they've known for many years, a spouse, a boss, and they won't be able to identify that person by look. They might identify the person by voice, or they might know that, you know, their kid has red Keds and they infer that it's the kid by looking at the shoes, but they can't put together the configuration of facial features to identify the person by face. There are a couple of cases of congenital prosopagnosia, but most of these occur much, much later in life, usually due to something like a stroke. Okay? So what Bauer was interested in is whether or not there was still the ability to in some way classify faces as familiar, but the problem would be accessing that information. So there's at least two kinds of problems that could give rise to prosopagnosia. One of which is you don't have the right information to be able to put together the configural features and identify the face, or you can't link that information to memory in some way. But the other might be you have bits of information, but somehow you can't make conscious use of the information that you have. So he administered a version of what's been termed the guilty knowledge test. We'll talk about this test much more in a couple of weeks when we talk about lie detection. It was developed by David Licken. And it's a test that was originally designed as a way of identifying people who might be lying about certain things. So if somebody's committed a crime, they might lie about the specific facts of the crime, and you could detect that they know that information. So the guilty knowledge test, in its original version, was a test where you assume that there are specific facts about a crime, and only a criminal or maybe a crime investigator, or maybe a victim, would know those particular facts. And so you create a multiple choice test where the different alternatives are plausible, but only one of them matches the crime. So when I was in graduate school, shortly after I read this paper, my car was stolen. And so I came up with a guilty knowledge test. So I still remember one of the items on there, I would say to the person, okay, well, if you stole the car, you know that something was taken out of the car. What was it? Was it a hat? Was it a jacket? Was it an umbrella? Was it an ice scraper? The things that you might plausibly have in your car in Minnesota. Right? Turns out it was an umbrella. So if somebody were guilty of stealing my car, or they were with the person who stole my car, then when the alternative umbrella comes up, they would have a recognition response, and that can be detected using skin conductance responding. What you tend to see is that in that sequence of multiple choice tests, one alternative coming after the next, people tend to have a maximal response to the relevant alternative. And you usually give several such items so that, you know, maybe somebody just has an umbrella fetish or something, they would respond highly to umbrellas. But, you know, if they also failed at about the type of car, failed at about where the car was dumped and so on, then ultimately, you know, you might suspect they know something about the event and maybe that they're in fact guilty of stealing the car. Okay? Now, obviously he didn't, you know, accuse the people of being prosopagnosic and ask them questions about it, but he set up a test much like this. And this was a test where he showed people a face that they ought to know, and then they heard different names that would match or not match the face. So set A that he gave to the patient had 10 photographs of very famous people, you know, politicians, actors, and things like that. And set B, family members, which, you know, ought to be pretty familiar to the patient. And during the display, there were 5 choices presented for the correct name, only one of which was correct. And they were presented in an auditory modality. So maybe something like this. Here's a famous face, and you would hear Joe, Dick, Elton, George, Bill. Okay? All right. Go away. All right. So, now, you might have had a big orienting response to that stimulus at first, but if I spaced out those alternatives quite a bit, presumably when the word George came up, you know, that would match, and you have a larger skin conductance response to that than the others. Of course, Elton was a particularly bad alternative. It's a rare name and, you know, doesn't really fit very well. So most of the rest were, you know, good exemplars. Okay. So that would be the idea. Okay. Now, he also had some controls, and they saw famous faces. They also saw the patient's family members. Okay. So they didn't see their own family members. And in terms of behavioral effects, the patient named 0 of the 10 famous faces upon presentation. Who is that? Didn't know. And 0 of the family members. So this just confirms that they're a good prosopagnosic patient. They have the condition of interest. The controls, they correctly named 9 of 10 of the famous faces on average, and none of the patient's family members because they didn't know the patient. Okay, so that makes sense. Okay. Now, in terms of electrodermal response, the patient produced the largest skin conductance response to the correct alternative for 60% of the famous faces, and controls did it 80% of the time, and that's not a significant difference. Clearly above what you'd expect by chance. You'd expect by chance it only to occur 20% of the time. And the patient showed the largest skin conductance response to 62.5% of his family members. Okay. Again, you'd expect by chance that to be 20%. The controls, not statistically above, but a little above, descriptively above the 20% chance. They had 37.5% of the time they had the maximal skin conductance response when the alternative matched the patient's family member's name. Okay. So that's an interesting set of findings, and it suggests, first of all, there's a clear dissociation between the behavioral measure and the psychophysiological measure. So this is an instance where psychophysiology is getting at something that's not available to conscious awareness or report. Okay. Now, the patient, at least at an autonomic level, is identifying faces. It's not just that, you know, it's not a study where they showed familiar faces and unfamiliar faces, and there was a bigger skin conductance response to the familiar face. That would only suggest that maybe there's some basic perceptual information that seems significant. But in fact, matching it to the name. So when the name matches, there was an autonomic response that differentiated them when the name didn't match. So that suggests some kind of autonomic level recognition. And what Bauer says is prosopagnosia involves a functional defect not at the perceptual level itself, but at a stage of processing where adequate perceptual information is utilized in some complex decision about stimulus identity. So it suggests the problem is a higher order problem. It also suggests, and I don't think it was tested out, some potentially innovative treatments or prosthetic devices. You can imagine, you know, there's like a list of names that a person could hear, and they have some kind of biofeedback system, and when the name matched, they would know, you know, who the person was. Doesn't seem particularly easy to use, but you know, you could imagine something like that.
Mm-hmm. I might have missed it.
Yeah.
The list of names for each, say, family base include alternate family members' names?
No, I don't think it did. Well, actually, take that back. I'd have to... That would be a much better control, right, because otherwise that would be a... I'll have to look at that. Mm-hmm. That would be a much better control. Mm-hmm. It would seem that it would have to, because otherwise they would just always have the biggest response to that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Slightly different study. This is a study that is examining phobic responses and really the development and extinguishment of phobic responses. So it's long been noted that there are certain kinds of stimuli that people develop phobic responses to much more easily than others, and these are things that probably have been around for a long period of time in terms of evolution, things that might have been advantageous to avoid. So people develop phobias rather easily to things like snakes, spiders, dogs, tissue damage, blood, things like that. And they don't develop phobias so easily to other equally dangerous things like guns and electrical outlets and speeding cars. Okay? But those can be things that would be dangerous. So this idea of prepared stimuli is of interest, and it suggests that there may be some kind of archaic information processing mechanisms that we've been selected to preferentially process features of these prepared stimuli and would allow us then to develop these phobias. So that would imply we don't need to have necessarily conscious awareness of the stimulus in order to develop or display a phobic response. Okay. So what Arne Ullmann and Joachim Soares did was use a conditioning paradigm. So if you're not familiar with the conditioning paradigm, there's two types of stimuli. A CS plus, that's the stimulus that is routinely paired with an unconditioned stimulus like an electric shock or a loud aversive noise. So the CS plus eventually is going to take on characteristics of the unconditioned stimulus. It'll elicit kind of a fear or phobic response if you keep pairing it with electrical shock, for example. The CS minus is not paired, so over time you don't develop any association to the CS minus. So they had several different kinds of stimuli that could serve either as CS plus or CS minus. There were fear-relevant things like snakes and spiders, and they had fear-irrelevant things like mushrooms and flowers, and these were all pictorial stimuli. And so during the acquisition trials, for any given set of trials, the CS plus gets an electric shock immediately following the presentation of the picture. CS minus does not. So you're an INDV 101 student, you come in, you sit down, you get the electrodes hooked up, and when the snake comes up, shock. Snake, shock. Mushroom, no. Or actually, I think they did it so it was snake, shock, spider, no shock. Or for your, you know, fellow subject, spider, shock, snake, no shock. Okay. And they also do it for, you know, flowers and mushrooms. And then, as you might imagine, then later on, if you just present the CS plus, the one that was paired with the shock, you'll have a larger skin conductance response. That just shows the conditioning, in fact, occurred. And that clearly happens when stimuli are presented above threshold with awareness. And when they're presented above threshold, that is with awareness, you can fully see the snake or the spider or the flower or the mushroom. There's no difference between fear-relevant and fear-irrelevant stimuli in terms of the magnitude of the skin conductance response. So no matter what the stimulus is, if you fear condition it using a CS plus paradigm with electric shock, you'll show a larger skin conductance response to it than to a non-paired stimulus. And it doesn't matter if it's, you know, evolutionarily fear relevant or not. Okay? So that seems to argue against this idea of preparedness. But then here's the interesting part. After acquisition, they used masked presentations. So they would put up the spider, the snake, the flower, or the mushroom, one on a trial, and mask it 30 milliseconds later, which should prevent there being any conscious awareness of what that stimulus was. It was a pattern mask. Okay? So people in the experiment probably just perceive a blob, some kind of a, you know, it's a mixed pattern mask. If anything, they probably maybe see a little flicker in a pattern mask, but they at 30 milliseconds, they can't reliably identify what the stimulus was at above chance levels. Okay. And when you do that and you measure the electrodermal response, masking eliminates the difference between CS plus and CS minus for those flowers and mushrooms, the ones that aren't fear relevant. But it doesn't eliminate the difference for the spiders and the snakes. So in other words, even without consciously seeing what it is, the fear conditioning persists. So that's going to suggest that this fear conditioning paradigm, at least for flowers and mushrooms and non-prepared stimuli, involves only cortical systems. There's some associative learning that goes on that involves cortex. When you mask the stimuli like that, what happens is that before the image can get to primary visual cortex where you're able to see it, the mask is already interfering with that information. So there are faster, quicker, shorter latency pathways, though, that would allow that information to go through subcortical systems, including the amygdala. And those are the ones that would be important then for this conditioning, the fear conditioning. Okay. So here's what it looks like in terms of the findings. So there were also fearful and non-fearful people in this study, people who were actually identified as phobics. And it turns out that doesn't matter that much. And now this is when the stimuli are masked. So when a fear-relevant CS plus is presented, you can see this very large skin conductance response for both fearful and non-fearful subjects, and compared to the fear-relevant CS minus. And so that for some subjects, their spiders are CS plus and snakes CS minus, some subjects vice versa. So that doesn't really matter. Clearly, there's an effect of the conditioning. And then for the irrelevant stimuli, you see it doesn't matter if they're CS plus or CS minus. They're pretty much like the CS minus for the fear-relevant stimulus. So it's only the combination of it being fear-relevant and having been conditioned that builds this particular effect. So they're saying that fear conditioning to non-prepared stimuli then might involve conscious mechanisms, but fear conditioning to prepared stimuli is possible through mechanisms outside of conscious or controlled information processing by use of the masking paradigm. And so this latter system might be fast and readily sensitive to danger cues in ways that people could feel a phobic response before they're fully consciously aware of why. Okay. And it might also explain why exposure therapy is critical to decrease these autonomic responses, because just, you know, consciously realizing that there's not a danger or consciously trying to control it isn't going to change it if this is rooted in systems that are outside of conscious awareness or cognitive control. Okay. All right. So another example is the use of psychophysiology to study something controversial, and that, in this case, is hypnosis. So this is a study by David Spiegel and some of his colleagues, including Carl Prebrum. And the first one of these in a series of studies appeared in the mid-80s in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology. So just a quick view of hypnosis. Hypnosis, contrary to what you see in terms of movies like The Jade Scorpion or Stage Hypnosis, is really just an individual difference variable. People differ in terms of how responsive they are to hypnotic suggestions. And those suggestions aren't of the nature that you see in movies and stage hypnosis, but they're suggestions like feeling like one's hand is extremely heavy when holding it out, so heavy that they can't hold it up. And people who are highly responsive to suggestion, their hand will fall faster. Or feeling their hand is unduly light, like it's being lifted up by a balloon. And people who are responsive will feel their hand going up. There are also items that involve, for example, anosmia, where you're screening a person for hypnotic susceptibility. You suggest that they're not able to smell anything, and then you stick a bottle of ammonia underneath their nose and have them take a big whiff. Of course, people who aren't responsive have a pretty adverse experience, but people who are responsive will report that they don't experience anything. Being able to perceive things that may not be there, suggesting they might hear things that, you know, aren't there, or suggesting they won't perceive things that are there, are also hypnotic phenomena. Now, most people are kind of in the low to medium range of hypnotic responsiveness. Almost everybody can feel their hand get kind of heavy. If you sit there in a relaxed state and somebody belabors the point for long enough, your hand will start to feel heavy. Many people can feel a little bit of lightness, can feel hands pushed together, pulled apart. But getting to these other things like anosmia or obstructive hallucinations or generating hallucinations, those are much more difficult. So in hypnosis research, you screen large numbers of people and you take the extremes, extremely highly hypnotizable people and then low hypnotizable people. And two issues recurrently arise in hypnosis. One of them is people wonder about the veracity of the effects. Is this demand characteristics? People are sitting there, they think they should be doing this, they feel like they should report in fact, that this is their experience. They may be just kind of succumbing to the demand characteristics of the experiment. Assuming that they are veritable phenomena, that they're not just somehow manipulating their response, then the question is, how would these be accomplished? So those are really a couple of questions that would be addressed by this study by Spiegel. Okay? Now, to understand this, I have to do a brief detour into event-related brain potentials. We'll come back to these in more detail later, but these are ERPs 101, and I'll just talk a little bit about what these are. Okay? So if you hook up a couple of electrodes on a person's head, you can measure an ongoing pattern of voltage change, that's here on the y-axis, as a function of time. So you see voltage oscillations over time. And what I'm displaying here is about almost 10 seconds worth of data. And we're looking at about 50 microvolts peak to peak. That's 50 millionths of a volt. Now imagine that I presented some stimulus at particular intervals. Here I'm doing it every couple of seconds or so. That could be a word, it could be a picture. In this case, it's just a light bulb because that was the icon that was easy to put in there. We would imagine that if an individual processed what that stimulus was, they see it, they categorize it, they make some decision about what they need to do to respond, and they respond, that should involve some neural systems that will reliably create an electrical signature. And so we should be able to pick that up. But in the ongoing context of brain activity, that signal is pretty small. So even though we think our experiment's the most important thing at the time, subjects' brains don't necessarily think so. Subject brains are busy doing other things, and it's not just that they're not paying attention to the experiment. I mean, even if they're really attending, the brain is responsible for doing many different things other than just the task at hand. And so that signal gets buried in the ongoing activity. But if we make an assumption, this assumption we'll return to later, that on each and every trial there is a visible signature that's pretty much the same from trial to trial, and that the background activity of the brain isn't in any way locked to when you bring these stimuli up. So I could present a stimulus when the background activity was negative, or present a stimulus when the background activity was positive. Then if I presented enough stimuli, the background activity should begin to average out to nothing. So that is likely to be positive as negative. So over many trials, that would average to nothing. What I'll see is only the activity that's present on every trial. And that would look something like this. Now this is looking across 1 second, 1,000 milliseconds. So it's a much smaller time window, just be like the time window from here to here. And you can see the y-axis is about 1/10 the size. We're looking at 5 microvolts peak to peak. So you can see how a signal this size would easily be buried in here. Okay? Now when we look at event-related potentials, most often positive is plotted down, and that's just an historical convention because the early amplifiers that had pens on paper, when the negative signal came in, the pen went towards the person, and the positive signal, the pen went away from the person. And so to this date, many people plot positive down, although people kind of feel like this, like they feel about, you know, their favorite beer or something, because they fight. It doesn't really make a difference, but they fight about it. Anyway, we're plotting positive down here. And there are different bumps that we see in the waveform. This would just be from a single site on the head. Of course, you have these from all over the head. And we label these different bumps in terms of their polarity, P for positive and N for negative. And then they can either be labeled in terms of their sequential occurrence, like P1, P2, P3, or they could be labeled in terms of their latency, like N400. Okay? Now, there's just two components that are relevant to this study. We'll come back and talk a lot about them later. But for right now, I'm going to start by focusing on the P3 component. So this is an issue of construct validity. What does it mean when we see a big P300, or what gives rise to a big P3? Well, when a stimulus is rare, significant, and task relevant, it will elicit a large P3 response. Okay? So if you're walking down the mall at the UA Mall, and it's stranger, friend. Okay? It's a rare, distinct, significant stimulus, and presumably elicits something like a P3 in that real-world situation. Okay? The other component that will be in these studies is the P1 component, and it's a component that's related to visual attention. So without getting into a lot of the nuances, greater visual attention will be associated with greater P1 amplitudes. Okay. So, if somebody's paying great attention to the stimulus and they detect it as significant, we should see an enhanced P1 and an enhanced P3. And by enhanced, I mean bigger dispersion in terms of the voltage axis. Okay? That's ERP's 101. All right. So back to our regularly scheduled study. Here's the design. They had very high or very low hypnotizable subjects. And the way this is typically done is first there's a mass hypnosis session given where hundreds of people will come in and they hear a tape-recorded hypnosis session, and then afterwards they report in a booklet their experiences. The people who look very high and very low on that are then invited in for an individual session. They're screened by one hypnotist researcher and one subject, one at a time, and the hypnotist actually notes what they do and they don't experience along the way. The people who are consistently very high or very low hypnotizable then are selected for such a study. And this was a study where they had objects on quadrants of a visual display, and they were given three different suggestions. One of them was a hypnotic enhancement suggestion, and that is that everything was going to look, or that one of two colored stimuli would look unusually bright and interesting, so that the blue vertical lines were going to be unusually bright and interesting. That was their hypnotic suggestion. The other hypnotic suggestion was hypnotic diminution. That was that the other color stimulus would look unusually drab, dull, and uninteresting. So, for example, the pink horizontal lines would look unusually drab, dull, and uninteresting. And then they had a hypnotic obstruction condition where they told people that they should visualize a cardboard box that would block the viewing of the monitor on which the stimuli were displayed. So they could not see the monitor. Okay, there would be a cardboard box blocking the monitor. Okay. So, of course, high and low people go through the same procedure. They're given hypnotic instructions. The low hypnotizable people just find them pretty relaxing, and the high hypnotizable people also then start to respond to suggestions more. And then they're given all three conditions within subjects in counterbalanced order. Okay. Now, they also had one additional control group for button pressing because they had to press when they saw targets. And, if you're obstructing something and you don't see it, you won't be pressing the button very often. But then that makes the high hypnotizable and the low hypnotizable people very different just in terms of how often they press the button. And that would be bad if any ERP differences were due to differences in frequency of button pressing. So they had a separate control group of people who were instructed. Yeah, additional control group. So it wasn't high or low. It was just a bunch of normal, non-selected people. And they had some conditions where they pressed a button, some conditions where they didn't press a button, just to see if pressing the button would cause any effects that were seen in the high hypnotizables versus low hypnotizables. Okay. So here's a bunch of squiggly ERPs. And there's three columns. These are the highly hypnotizable people, these are the low hypnotizable people, and these are the button pressing controls. And each row is a different site on the head. This is the EOG, the electrooculogram. This shows how much the eyes are moving. And that becomes important because when eyes move, they create electrical potentials that can be picked up on the EEG leads. So you want to see that there's no difference between the conditions in eye movements. So those are very, very small. That looks pretty good. These are two occipital leads near the back of the head. PZ is a parietal lead right on the midline. CZ, central midline, and FC is frontal midline. There are three types of stimuli diagrammed on each of these. There's the hypnotic enhancement condition, which is the dark line, the hypnotic diminution condition, which is the dimmer solid line, and hypnotic obstruction condition, which is, in fact, the dashed line. And so what you can see here, comparing the low versus high hypnotizable, especially at the occipital leads over the visual cortex, is that the low hypnotizable show very little difference between the conditions. I mean, there's a tiny bit here, but it's pretty small. But look at the high hypnotizables. They show a small difference between enhancement and diminution, but compared to obstruction, they show very little at all. In terms of button pressing control, it doesn't matter if you press the button or you don't. Those ERPs line up just almost perfectly. So this difference can't be accounted for by button pressing, per se. Okay. If you also look here at the PZ electrode, this is where P3 effects should be maximal, and you can see again there's a huge difference between the obstruction condition and the two other conditions in the high hypnotizables and not in the low hypnotizables. Okay. So they did a subsequent study using somatosensory ERPs. This was, I think, vibratory stimuli. Might have been shock, but I think it was vibratory stimuli. No, it was mildly painful, so it must have been shock. In this study, they gave people suggestion to block pain. So hypnotic analgesia is a well-studied phenomenon. And it's one of those where people have a harder time arguing demand characteristics. You know, people go through dental procedures with hypnosis. And, you know, unless they're just really macho, what would be the point of saying, I don't feel any pain under hypnosis unless it was actually working? So they're given the suggestion, the highly hypnotizable and low hypnotizable people to block this mildly painful stimulus. And the high hypnotizable people reduced P1 and P3 amplitudes, but not the low hypnotizable subjects. And they also, in this one, had an increased intensity manipulation too, so that the stimulus would appear more intense or painful than usual. And they found an increase in P1 amplitude, but only in the high hypnotizable subjects. So what Spiegel et al. Are arguing is collectively these studies suggest that there's an so you can imagine two things in hypnosis. One is, it doesn't alter my fundamental perceptual experience, it alters my interpretation of what's happening. The other is, it may alter my fundamental perceptual experience in some way. And they're arguing the latter. I don't think it's without some argument against it, but it's overall, it's an impressive set of findings. So collectively, these studies suggest that alterations are at the level of signal detection and not just the interpretation of the signal. But to really make that claim, we'd have to go back and show that these early P1 effects that I alluded to in that study and that you see here, could those P1 effects in any way be achieved through some mechanism in non-hypnotizable people? Could you volitionally control that? On that order of magnitude, I've not seen it before. There are small differences with attention, but that's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. When it says there's an increase in the P1, does that mean a positive or a negative?
No, it's more positive. It's more positive voltage. Right, so you would see like that. You could say there's a larger P1 here than here in the button pressing control than either of the hypnotic groups.
Mm-hmm. Yes. An increase in the N400 would be more negative.
Yes, an increase in N400 would be more negative, right? So an increase in a component is more in its target direction, right? So larger N400s are more negative, larger P300s are more positive, right? Okay. All right. So here's another application. This is one related to deception detection. So here's a case not where people can't tell you something about their experience, it's that they won't tell you something about their experience because they don't want to be found out. Right? Asking that they did something or they committed some crime or they know some information and they don't want to tell you. So we'll come back and talk about conventional polygraphy using the standard polygraph test with skin conductance as used in the field still today. It's unacceptably inaccurate. It's a dreadful procedure. And I'll say it's a dreadful procedure in a 60-minute lecture, but it's a dreadful procedure. So maybe we could improve upon that procedure. The guilty knowledge technique that I mentioned is not a standard kind of polygraph procedure. It's an improvement. But it still relies on autonomic responses, like the skin conductance response, which can be willfully manipulated. In fact, if you go on the web and go to sites like antipolygraph.org or type in countermeasures, you can find out how to beat the polygraph test by manipulating your skin conductance response or your autonomic arousal. So Larry Farwell and Manny Donchin reasoned that maybe instead of relying on autonomic features, they could rely on event-related brain potentials. In theory, it might be harder to think about how to manipulate those. The latency is pretty quick, and people wouldn't have quite the same intuitive sense of how to manipulate them. Okay. So that was the theory. So here's the rationale. You have kind of a multiple choice test, and if you're a criminal, you'll recognize some key facet of a crime, and if you're not the criminal, you wouldn't recognize that key facet of the crime. So a bank was held up, and the hold-up note was written on something. What was that? Was it a deposit slip? Was it a candy bar wrapper? Was it a McDonald's napkin? There'd be a bunch of things, and presumably if you were the robber, you would know that it was the McDonald's napkin, for example. So now we have a series of items coming along, one of which stands out as distinct, rare, and significant because it's relevant to the crime. Okay. And if so, then we'd see the big P3 response here. So again, positive down. There's a big P3 to that one alternative compared to the other alternatives. But if it wasn't recognized, then it wouldn't really, this solid line here doesn't look any different than all the dotted lines around it, meaning that alternative, McDonald's napkin, doesn't look any more significant or task relevant than any of the other alternatives. Okay? So this would be repeated with many different kinds of items, the getaway car, the time of the crime, the color of hair of the bank teller, I mean, any kinds of things that might be encoded by the criminal. Okay? So we'd expect for a criminal type, we should see a big P3 to the relevant items to the crime, and if somebody's innocent, then it should look pretty much indistinguishable from the other alternatives. So that's the basic rationale. And they had a kind of a complicated way of, sure, we're going to pause for a video tape. P for positive. It's the third major positive peak, but as you'll see when we get to the ERP lecture, I mean, there's many little positive peaks that occur before it, but they're very, very tiny, and you need many, many trials to see them, things like in the brainstem.
So the third one is the standard one.
Okay. Yes.
Why
three? I guess. Yeah. Okay. But P3 just stands for the third major positive peak. It was originally called P300 because in simple auditory discrimination tasks, it occurred at about 300 milliseconds, but the more complex discriminations like visual stimuli or word stimuli, it appears at about 500 to 600 milliseconds, so it's now generally called P3.
To take time out of it,
it's the third positive peak, right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Farwell and Donchin then had this rationale that if recognized, you should see a large P3 to the relevant alternative, and if not, you wouldn't. And then because ERPs require lots of trials, this would be repeated. You might have maybe 6-7 different kinds of crime facts, and then the whole thing would be repeated multiple times, say, you know, 10 times each, for example. Okay. They had a complicated system, but this is just an index of the extent to which the relevant alternative appeared to have a big P3 versus it appeared to look indistinguishable from the other items. And what you can see is innocent subjects tend to cluster over here, and guilty subjects tend to cluster over here, with a few subjects right here in the middle. So they decided, Farwell and Donchin, to create an innocent cut point, a guilty cut point, and an indeterminate group in the middle. And when you do that, if you forget about the fact you don't say anything about these guys, you do perfectly. Okay? So it perfectly separates guilty from innocent people, having 5 out of 40 people, 12.5%, be unclassified. Okay? So that's pretty exciting. I did some work on this, looking at this as a possibility for clinical malingering. So imagine in this scenario that you know, your irresponsible friend has a car accident, and you did manage to hit your head against the window because the irresponsible friend didn't have side impact airbags. And a lawyer comes and tells you, hey, you know, that can cause memory deficits, and you know, maybe there'd be a settlement for you. Okay? Now, if you weren't the upstanding individual that you were, you could imagine, well, if I was given a memory test, then I might look like I have amnesia. Okay? Some people, I know it comes as a shock, some people might do such a thing. So what I did was I had subjects with intact memory, college student subjects, come in, and I taught them a list of words that I later told them to conceal. I taught them a list of words that I told them that they should always let me know that they learned, and then there were words they hadn't seen. So they learned a list of words till they knew it perfectly. They learn a second list of words, and then comes this task, where there are words that they learned earlier they have to conceal, words they learned recently that they don't conceal, and words they've never learned. I did this under three sets of instructions. One set of instructions just told them, I'd like you to respond yes to the recently learned words and no to those earlier words that when you see them, and try to keep your brain activity from letting me know that you saw those words. And then in these two conditions, I explicitly directed them to lie, where I said, I want to know all the words you learned today, but you should lie about that first list of words. And in this condition, I also said, if you're successful in lying, I'll give you a monetary reward, which was $5 in 1988, so $10 or so today, to poor college students in Minnesota. So what you can see, positive down, P3 here, these are grand averages across 20 subjects. They've been filtered, so pretty clean. Is in all cases, whether a subject says, no, I didn't learn the item, or yes, I did, no, I didn't, or yes, I did, no, I didn't, or yes, I did, those learned items produce larger P3s than the unlearned items. So again, it's sensitive not to what they say, but sensitive to what actually happened, to objective truth. Okay. Tell us some more to say about that later in the lecture. There's other studies that have followed up on this by us and by other labs. Okay. By the way, the classification with this was about 95% accurate, so, which was pretty good. I didn't have any indeterminate verdicts. Okay. Larry Farwell and Manny Donchin also got involved in another line of work. This was work looking at whether or not one could develop a brain-computer interface. So some people are unable to respond because they may have conditions that prevent them from so doing. Probably the most common of these and the worst is ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. And this is, over time, people become what's called locked in. So we believe that they still have active mental life, but they're unable to respond, even at the level of eye blinks or ocular movements. So they were wondering, would there be some way to allow them to use brain electrical activity to interact with the environment? So they developed an ERP system for communication that didn't involve any overt motor movement. What they wanted to do was to see if when we presented stimuli, by looking at the P3, could we detect what was significant to the subject. And so it would be for locked-in patients. So what they did is they presented this matrix of letters and a few different functions. So you see A, B, C through F, so it's just the alphabet going from top to bottom. I can't remember what the asterisks were. And then there was a space bar, like between words, backspace if you made an error, talk, which would actually have the machine articulate what was just there. So in this case, if you spelled out brain and you hit talk, the machine would say brain. And quit means you've really had enough and you're done. Now the way that they did this was, imagine that all these letters are a little bit dim, and then in very rapid succession, they flash rows and columns. So a row would be lit up and all the different letters across the row would you know, flash in rapid sequence. The next row, all the letters would flash in rapid sequence, so one right after the other. Now, if you're attending just to, like, I, for example, you want to start a sentence with I, you're attending to that. When this row flashes, you know, it shouldn't be significant. This row flashes, it shouldn't be significant. This row flashes. When it gets to the second one, that will seem significant, okay, and then again, these won't. Now, the P3 has a latency that can be determined, and so each of these occurs at a different time. So when you see the P3 latency lined up to the flash that was with that letter, and then you could see actually that was in response, that the person was attending to that letter. Okay? And by attending, it doesn't mean they have to move their eyes, because they can't if they have locked-in syndrome. They're looking at the whole display, and it subtends a small enough visual area that it's just what they're cognitively attending to. Okay? So that's the idea behind this, what they're calling the mental prosthesis. And the result of that was that it actually did work. And through this identification, like I described, they had a complex signal detection procedure. They could get people to actually identify about 2.3 characters per minute. Now, that's pretty slow, right, compared to typing or certainly compared to speaking. But if it's the only way to communicate, then that would certainly be better than nothing. Now, since that time, there's been a lot of additional work done. Niels Birbaumer has done quite a bit of this, and there are a few different methods that Niels has used in this work. Niels was a president of SPR just a couple of years ago. One of these is looking at people's ability to learn to regulate their cortical slow potentials. So, you know, the ERP, you saw a rapid succession of peaks and valleys. And in this one, I don't know how well you can see it here. Here's a yellow line. After an initial start, you see there's a quick rise where they keep that potential high for a long period of time. They shift the voltage over a region of cortex and keep it shifted for that period of time. There's work that shows that also corresponds to hemodynamic changes over the region of cortex that's close to that electrode. Now, it takes quite a while to train people to do this, but then they can learn to do this pretty readily and pretty rapidly, and then based upon their doing this, you can have a cursor move to point to different letters on an array. So instead of a passive system where they're just attending and the ERP is detecting what they're attending to, here's a system where they're using their brain activity. They've been trained to move their slow cortical potentials. I think it goes negative. Then they can move the cursor until it points to something, and then they stop with the slow cortical potential. And then each letter that they spell appears on the top of the screen. This system is also fairly slow, on the order of a character or two per minute as well. Because okay? You have to get the cortical potential, then you're moving it, and you got to move it back. You can just imagine it's probably like, it feels a little like driving a barge, because you're trying to hone in on that. Or if you remember way back to when you first got a touchpad or something, and it felt like you were kind of clumsy on it. But again, it's a way that they can do it. And here's an ALS patient, stay on a respirator because he's not able to voluntarily move. Now, another technique that's been used is sensomotor rhythm training. This is like a high alpha frequency rhythm that you see over the somatosensory and motor cortex. And people can also be taught to block or enhance this rhythm. They usually do so by imagining movements of the hands or the fingers on that side. And so in this training here's a cursor, and without moving anything, they're taught to change their sensomotor rhythm over the left or the right, and you can see over time the cursor goes up, and that's the wrong way, they bring it back down, they're trying to bump into this thing. So they can learn to move a cursor again by changing this rhythm. So both the slow cortical potentials and the sensomotor rhythm training are biofeedback procedures. People learn how to alter their cortical potentials, and they see the impact on the screen. So they've actually done this with flight simulators, and people can, do flight simulators by just altering their cortical potentials. It's obviously not ready for prime time. Airplanes still have joysticks and devices to do it manually. So that's another way then that one could control a joystick. And then the final method is just an enhanced version of what you saw with the Farwell and Donchin technique. Manny Donchin has carried this work on. You can see here's an example. So again, we have a matrix. This time the letters of the alphabet go across, A through F, G through L, and so on, and some numbers. And so each column will flash, and so this column right now illuminates, all of the column turns white, and then in rapid succession, each one of the circles turns red. So if the person's paying attention to P, again, they would have a maximal P3 response to P. So if you line up the ERP in time to all the stimuli except the one here, if they're actually attending to it, you'll get a response like this. So here you see, this time positive's up. There's a big P3 response to that target and not to any of the others. But if you lined up like M compared to everything, then it would just overlay all the others. It wouldn't look any different than the others. So again, there's fairly good discrimination based upon this procedure. And I think they've got the rate of characters up a little bit higher, but it's still in the order of just a few characters per minute. Okay. So the first two are based on an active control by the patient through biofeedback, and then this one, like the Farwell and Donchin method, is based upon a passive method where paying attention. I mean, they actively pay attention, but they don't control anything in the process. Okay. All right. So the last thing I'll talk about is just a study that a former student, Zia Dickman, did for his master's when he was here. And this is a study looking at psychopathy, or in our case, we didn't have real psychopaths, we had kind of people along a continuum of manipulative and undesirable behavior. So we took these people also out of the undergraduate subject pool from INDV 101, and they're people who scored extremely high, the upper 2% on being, or the lower 2% on being socialized. So they don't endorse that they like to follow rules, they don't think that other people's feelings mean much, they don't mind manipulating other people, they're generally fairly callous, carefree, people who probably don't have a lot of long-term friends because they, end up taking advantage of them. Okay. Now, we use that as a convenience group because it is hard to get psychophysiological equipment in and out of prisons. It's a great. If I were a nefarious kind of guy, I could put a lot of stuff in a psychophysiological piece of equipment and get it into a prison. So there's lots of impediments. It's not that it can't be done, but it's hard if you don't have a good relationship with your local prison. Anyway. what has been documented in psychopathy in, well over a half century of study, is that psychopaths are clearly able to learn to chase reward, but they don't do particularly well at learning to avoid punishments. So you think of phenomenologically what happens to psychopaths, they get kind of greedy. They go for the money, they go for, something of interest, and they don't necessarily anticipate the potentially aversive outcomes that might befall them if they're caught, right? And there are a couple of ways in which people have conceptualized theoretically what's going on. An early account by David Licken was essentially that these people are relatively fearless, or in particular, they don't develop the anticipatory anxiety that many people would see when they're faced with a potential punishment. Okay. There was a classic study where when psychopaths are waiting for an electric shock and there's a countdown to that electric shock, 8, 7, 6, non-psychopaths start to show a huge increase in skin conductance, they get kind of wigged out. Psychopaths, skin conductance, as cool as a cucumber, just bumps up right at the end. So they don't show this deficient, they show a deficient anticipatory anxiety. But others have said maybe that what is actually going on is it's not just that they're fearless, it's that they seem, they don't focus on that. They're focusing so much on the reward. And these deficits really come out in tasks where you have a reward simultaneously with the possibility of a loss. And they overfocus on the reward, and then they don't see the potential for some kind of aversive outcome. So there have been plenty of different autonomic experiments, like the one I just talked about, the countdown shock task, for example, that corroborate this deficient anticipatory anxiety hypothesis. But what we raised in this study was the possibility, perhaps, that we'd see a deficit at the central nervous system level in terms of how they categorize the consequences of their actions relative to rewards and punishments. So if they make a response that's going to get reward versus punishment, are there also differences there? So one thing is they're perfectly able to know what these outcomes are and they ascribe significance to them, but there's some autonomic deficit. Or it could be that there's also a deficit at the central nervous system level in terms of the salience they assign to rewards and punishments. So we used we had these analog psychopaths, these extremely low socialized college students, and they were run under conditions of reward and punishment. We tried to be blind to subject group, but I should tell you, when you have the upper 2% of socialized students and the lower 2% of socialized students, it wasn't that much of a secret in terms of dress, demeanor, reliability showing up, people we had to send home drunk, the number of different things. So, okay. Now, we used a different kind of event-related potential. This is one we'll also talk about again later. And this is known as the error-related negativity. So what I've shown you so far is we look at brain activity following a stimulus, like a somatosensory stimulus in the Spiegel study, a word in the study of deception detection. But you can also look at activity aligned with a person's response. So you don't align it with the stimulus, you align it with the response, you average all the other activity averages out, and what you're left with is that activity that seems related to the response. Now this is a study, you'll be reading this study later, it's the one by Bill Gehring. It's one of the first studies to present findings on what's known as the error-related negativity. So once again, we have positive going up, and we have negative going up, positive going down. And what you see is a huge response here following the error. It's a big negativity. And actually, these are all different errors. There are actually no correct on this screen, but a correct response would typically look like this one. This is the smallest quartile of ERN responses. So for a moment, just imagine that there were some responses where subjects were correct. They would look pretty much like this waveform here. And then these are just different quartiles of size of the ERN. Okay. The reason I show this slide is it tells us a little bit about what the ERN is sensitive to. So what they did was they tried to categorize each individual trial as to whether or not it would have a large or a small ERN. They were clearly successful because when they averaged them together, there's big ERNs and medium ERNs and tiny ERNs and apparent absence of ERNs. Okay. Then what they did is they looked, given this physiological response, this ERN, what kinds of correlates were there in terms of behavior? So what you see is when they have a larger ERN, they have a more tentative wrong response. It's almost like they have some awareness, or at least something in the system is telling them that this might not be a good choice. When they have the smallest ERN, they squeeze the hardest. It's almost like they were unaware that there was an error. The largest ERN also correlates with a greater probability of changing their response. So in these kinds of tasks where they're categorizing things, you can easily say, oh crap, and do the right one. You make a switch. And that probability of self-correcting increases with the magnitude of the ERN. Okay. Also, if you know you made a mistake, you might want to be more careful on the next trial, and so you might slow down. So here we see for the largest ERN, people also show the greatest response slowing on the next trial. So a large ERN seems to be associated with a more tentative error response, a greater probability of self-correction, and a slowing on the next trial. So larger ERNs seem to be related to people's, I don't want to say awareness, that would be a debatable point, but the significance of the error and the extent to which they subsequently can identify they made an error. So larger ERNs should be affiliated with greater salience of an error is the point that Zia Dickman and I were making for this study. Okay. So in this study then we have highly socialized people, those are not psychopathic at all, low socialized people, those are psychopathic-like, and then we have conditions where on every trial, if they're correct they win some money, and if they're wrong, they don't. So that's the reward condition. So making an error means they don't get the reward. And we also have an avoidance learning condition where on every trial they're right, nothing happens, but if they're wrong, they get a 95 decibel noise blast in the headphones, which is aversive. It's not painful, but it's aversive. Okay? So these are head maps from the top. These are kind of last generation head maps. They're not really very pretty, but here we have highly socialized individuals, and we're looking at the pattern of voltage across the scalp. Nose here is up, this fancy nose. And blue is more negative, -9 microvolts. And so when highly socialized people, the people who are not at all like psychopaths, make an error, it doesn't matter if they're not going to get their reward or they're about to get an aversive noise blast. They show pretty much the same amplitude. So the deepness of the blue shows you the amplitude of the waveform. Okay. But now we look at our low socialized, our analog psychopath group. When they make an error that signifies they're about to get blasted with noise, they show an ERN, but it's considerably smaller. And when they make an error that shows that they're not going to get their reward, they show a much larger ERN. Okay. Now these are in tasks where it's pretty obvious to essentially make a reward, an error. They're simple categorization tasks. So clearly there's much greater salience associated with an error that suggests you won't get a reward than an error that is going to get punishment. And that's not true of their highly socialized counterparts. And just to give you a kind of a preview of other things that one can do when you have EEG data like this, you can see this is something that's very focal. You only see it right here along the central midline area. So that suggests the possibility of there being just, you know, one or maybe a limited set of generators underneath. And there's modeling procedures where you can identify what would be the likely source of that potential you see. And this is the best fit. It accounts for over 90% of the variance, 9.6% left unexplained, in the time frame where you see the ERN. And so it's right here that is in the anterior cingulate region, which is consistent with what we see in the ERN. It's not like MRI where we can say we know it's the case, but we can say this model fits the data pretty well. It accounts for much of the variance. And it's a plausible hypothesis given what we know with other studies and other kinds of methodologies. So when you do error tasks in the scanner, you see hemodynamic changes often in the anterior cingulate cortex as well. Okay, so that would suggest then that it's not just an autonomic deficient anticipatory anxiety, but really they're ascribing different salience to these errors here, and we're picking that up at the central level. Okay. All right. So coming up next week then, we'll start with basic electricity, and then we'll move on to basic neurophysiology and neuroanatomy. So go ahead and read those chapters and start working on preparing for your electricity test. Don't forget to turn in your 3x5 cards tonight so I can give you credit for attendance and see what kinds of questions that you might have. Okay. We'll see you next time.